completed tours aboard this vessel, 20,615. Satisfactory performance reviews, 11. Unsatisfactory performance reviews, none. A complete record of Captain Volkova's verbal commands, voice profile, ship actions, and journey logs have been appended to this report. Would you like to hear them now? Hannah is about to say yes again, but that would mean listening to 12 years of logs. No, she says eventually. It's barely a whisper. Report will be transmitted at next available contact with Sigma Station Control. Sigma Station beacons not detected. Recovery ship beacons not detected. Emergency destination coordinates not detected. Wait, Hannah says. She closes her eyes for a second, wondering how to phrase it. Are the external comms? Can we transmit? Correct. Communication systems are nominal. Hannah slumps back against the seat, closing her eyes again. Okay. Comms are good. Now they just have to hope they stay that way, and that all the million other insane things they're about to do go off without a hitch. In the event of the loss of ship commanding officer without direction from station command, the computer says, control is to be passed to a capable passenger or staff member. Please confirm you are a capable passenger or staff member. Confirm, Hannah says. She's still barely able to speak. Autopilot engaged. No proximity detected. Manual control may be required to guide this vessel to safety. Would you like to run the emergency ship control tutorial? Hannah blinks.
There's a tutorial.
Correct. All vessels operated by Sigma Destination Tours contain multiple layers of safety protocols. In the event of a loss of command combined with no signal from a recovery beacon, a capable passenger or staff member may need to take control of the ship. The tutorial covers basic steering, thruster operation, and radio operation. Would you like to run the emergency ship control tutorial? Hannah sits back in her chair, stunned relief washing over her. The Red Panda might not have additional food supplies in its escape pod. It might be only barely capable of working in space. But at some point in the distant past, some company programmer decided to create an emergency tutorial program, and right now, it looks like it might just save their lives. She's about to tell the panda to run the tutorial when she gets the craziest idea.
Computer, did you say you kept a voice profile of Captain Volkova?
Correct. Over Captain Volkova's service period of 12 years, 3 months, 22 days, and unknown period, all verbal commands and voice patterns were recorded and stored, as per Sigma Destination Store's staff data analysis regulations.
Can you? She stops, unsure how to phrase it. Can you speak as her, with her voice?
I am capable of transmitting commands in over 400 different frontier-recognized languages and over 50 accents.
But can you switch your voice pattern to the captain's? It sounds stupid even as she says it. What are you doing?
She's expecting the computer to say no. And why wouldn't it? The whole idea is crazy. Volkova is dead, and she's on her own. But to her surprise, the ship immediately says, that is correct. Would you like me to switch to Captain Volkova's stored voice patterns for the emergency ship tutorial?
In astonishment, Hannah says, yes, confirm. There's a split-second pause, then the thick, Russian-accented voice of Yana Volkova comes from the speakers.
Welcome to the emergency ship tutorial for the Red Panda, a Sigma Destination Tours vessel. Please state your name.
Hannah tries to speak and finds that she's crying. Tears roll down her face, dripping onto her forearms. She hugs herself tight.
Please state your name, Volkova repeats.
She means to say Hannah Elliot, but what comes out when she finally finds her voice is,
"Guide. My name is Guide."
"Welcome, Guide. This tutorial will demonstrate how to safely operate this vessel. Please place your hands on the control stick, as shown in the on-screen diagram immediately ahead of you."
Hannah does so. Her hands only shake a little.
"Please confirm you are ready to begin the control tutorial."
"I'm ready."
Through her tears, Hannah smiles.
"Tell me a story."
Chapter 57. Lorinda takes extra care to make sure she looks calm, even if she doesn't feel anywhere close to it. She has an idea that if she doesn't, Jack is going to pass out. She remembers the first time she went out in the belt, remembers how difficult it was, and she'd had a whole month of training beforehand. You didn't move like you expected out there. Everything was exaggerated. Every single movement had consequences. Jack probably doesn't know the specifics, but he's got an idea, and it isn't hard to see that he's on the verge of freaking out. So she keeps an easy smile on her face, relaxes her shoulders as she helps him into his suit. It's not as hard to do as she thought it would be. If they make it through this, she thinks, maybe she should consider politics, like Anita, run for office somewhere. If they make it. They have no idea when the other ship is going to arrive. Roman couldn't tell them, saying it was a decision that would have been made by the commander back at their outpost. They decided to get him and Jack ready, so they can leave as soon as it appears. This is going to be tricky, and not just for Jack. For the thousandth time, she tries to think of a way she can take Jack's place. She keeps coming up on that one thing. If they're going to get to the other ship's bridge, whoever is with Roman has to pass as military. She can't. Corey and Malik are still on the main deck, and Hannah has made her way to the cockpit, leaving only Everett, Anita, Jack, and Roman in the bar. And Seema, of course, her body lying on the far side of the room. Thank God Lorinda doesn't have to look at her. Brendan is out, too. They talked about it, but decided to use the handcuffs that previously restrained Roman on him, rather than keeping him locked in a frigid bathroom. He's sitting on the stairs, hands cuffed behind him. Everett is with him, gripping his upper arm. His eyes are bleary, wincing in pain every time he moves, his face a mangled, red mess. He hasn't said a word. And although he tried to fight them when they opened the bathroom door, they subdued him without too much trouble. Roman got him in a headlock, and Anita cuffed him. He got docile after that, too dazed to keep struggling. Lorinda locks Jack's right glove in place, while Roman busies himself securing the seals on his neck. His suit is still on, and, despite its bulkiness, he moves with an efficient, focused grace. Lorinda catches Jack's eye.
"Almost done," she says, still smiling.
Jack nods, swallowing.
"Take me through it again," Lorinda says to him. "We've done it twice already."
She doesn't budge.
"Again."
Jack lifts his left hand, showing her the joystick module.
"This controls where I'm facing, up, down, side to side."
He taps the rocker switch on top of the stick.
"Forward and backward."
"Good." She looks at him expectantly. He sighs, eyes closed, as if trying to remember.
"Gentle movements. I got it." "Yep. Short, controlled bursts on the thrusters. Everything you do out there is going to be magnified. Now, what are you not going to do?"
"Move my arms?"
"Exactly. This isn't like a swimming pool. You can't..."
"I know that."
She ignores him.
"You can't swim through it.
Every movement you make is going to affect your attitude and your position. Eyeball your target. There should be a set of red lights above the airlock. She looks to Roman for confirmation, and he nods.
You listen to her,
he says, jerking his chin at Lorinda.
She knows what she's talking about.
Yeah, well. Lorinda checks Jack's right glove seal, still not quite satisfied. 40 years on the belt will do that to you.
You were a miner?
That's right.
Helium-3?
Uh-huh. She starts checking the other glove seal. Some tungsten, too, on occasion.
Knew a couple of prospectors. Not an easy job.
We did okay. She gives him a tight smile, then turns back to Jack. Now, you stay close behind Roman, but give him room to maneuver. Let him take the lead. She waits for him to respond. He doesn't. Jack, look at me. He looks at her.
I'll be there every step of the way.
She taps her ear.
Just listen to my voice on your comms. I can't see your suit HUD, but I'll be able to see you. If I tell you to do something, you don't argue, you just do it. Got it? Yeah. Yeah, okay, sure. Don't worry, she says. We'll be right behind you.
The corners of Jack's mouth twitch.
You'd better.
Roman secures his neck seals. There's a click hiss as they tighten, making Jack wince. The soldier's grey suit stands out in contrast to Jack's white one. High-level military tech, next to the cheapest, most cost-effective space solution that Sigma Destination Tours could afford. Still, the story they've worked out sounds pretty plausible. The Resolute suffered a catastrophic engine failure, and Roman and Jack were the only ones to make it out. They took refuge in the Panda, which they'll maintain they boarded, taking care of the passengers, a detail that made Lorinda uneasy. Jack's military suit was damaged, so he swapped it for one on board the Panda. He isn't wearing the same military clothes as Roman underneath the suit, but that's something they're just going to have to live with. Roman looks towards the airlock, impatient. None of them are looking towards the back of the bar, so none of them see Seema stir, see her foot twitch.
And when we're on the bridge, Roman says. What is it with you people?
Says Jack.
I'm not 5.
Roman gives him a hard look. Jack sighs.
Fine. I control our drift during the jump using the 2 sticks below the display. Reticle in the center should be fine. And what?
Roman waits.
And, Jack says, sounding annoyed. It's not always possible to get a read on how close we are to the edge of the bubble, just from reading the display. I have to watch out for the vibration, or we'll be ripped right out of it. See? I got it.
Roman speaks in a focused monotone.
Now, like I said, I won't be able to help you. I'll be on the other side of the bridge, working on the matter shielding. If you get into trouble, you're on your own. Understand?
Wait!
Corey and Malik are at the top of the stairs, older brother supporting younger. Corey's face is twisted in pain, his skin shiny with sweat. Lorinda blinks in astonishment. A second later, it's replaced by an almost embarrassed warmth. He wants to be part of it. His leg is smashed up, and he still wants to be here.
Did you tell him about the thrusters?
Corey shouts.
I did, dear. Thank you.
Because if he doesn't know to go easy on the...
Seema explodes out from behind the bar. Whatever trauma her body suffered has shut down her mind, turned her eyes red and unfocused. But her body is still working, stumbling, lurching, charging towards them, like a cornered animal lashing out. There's muscle memory there, 1,000 fights guiding her, and it gives her strength. Her feet thunder on the floor plates, and the noise is so startling that it locks everyone into place for a crucial half second. Roman reacts first, darting out from behind Jack. But at that moment, Brendan charges off the stairs, yelling his wife's name. His hands are still cuffed behind him, and at that moment, Lorinda isn't sure if he even knows what he's doing. Roman tries to slip past him, but his suit makes the move awkward. He can't get out of the way in time, and Brendan collides with him, sending them both crashing into the bar. Corey yells in horror as Everett scrambles to intercept Seema. Lorinda finds she can't move, can't look away from those insane eyes. Sticky spittle dribbles out of the corner of Seema's mouth. She's heading straight for Jack. Lorinda reacts before she can think about it, stepping in front of him, her only thought that they need the suit, that they're finished without it. Seema hits her with the momentum of a meteorite plunging through the atmosphere, bending her in half at the waist. Roman has got out from under Brendan, but he's too far away to help. Lorinda crashes into Jack, Seema's hands gripping the neck seal, twisting it. For a second, the three of them are locked together, and Lorinda sees the room frozen. Corey and Malik at the top of the stairs, mouth formed in shocked O's. Confusion on Everett's face. Roman and Anita reaching for Seema, not even close to catching her. Then momentum rips all of them apart. Jack goes flying, skidding across the floor. Lorinda goes right over the top of him, slamming against the closed airlock door, the back of her head colliding with it. There's a pop, deep in her mind, like an overloaded fuse burning out. Things go soft and dark and silent. Chapter 58. Everett gets to Seema a split second too late. She whirls, distracted, which is when Roman reaches round and snaps her neck. It's a single, quick motion, a jerk that owes more to careful placement than to raw strength. The sound is a grisly crack.
No!
It's Brendan. He's stumbling away from the bar, stunned fury on his face. Everett and Anita grab him, holding him in place. He's so angry he nearly throws them off. Hannah's voice comes crackling over the ceiling speakers.
"Hearing weird noises from down there," she says, trying to sound casual and failing miserably. "Someone come give me a status update."
Roman is clicking his fingers rapidly in front of Lorinda's face. Her head is tilted to one side. Her eyes closed, skin pale. Jack can see the beginnings of an enormous bruise feathering the edge of her hairline, just behind her ear.
"Nothing," Roman says.
"What do you mean, nothing?"
Anita is back on her feet, staring down in horror at Lorinda.
"No response."
Roman touches the bruise.
"She's had a TBI, if..."
What the hell is a TBI?
Roman's voice doesn't change.
"Traumatic brain injury."
"Is she okay?"
Corey shouts. He and Malik are still frozen on the stairs.
"How can you be so sure?" says Everett, still on top of the handcuffed Brendan.
Roman lifts Lorinda's eyelid, exposing nothing but white.
"She's unresponsive to external stimuli. And this bruise, here? Subcranial swelling."
He pops his glove, putting a finger to Lorinda's neck.
"No pulse,"
he says. And that's when Jack realizes. He never checked that Seema was dead.
"No, that's wrong. I..."
He didn't. He was going to. But his nose was a throbbing nightmare. His brain a mess of adrenaline. And he'd heard the crack when her neck hit the edge of the bar. No way anybody would survive that. He'd pushed the whole thing out of his mind, telling himself there was no point, his exhausted body eagerly complying. His gaze lands on the airlock door, on the spot where Lorinda's head hit it. The surface is actually dented, and there's a tiny smear of blood nestled inside it. She's gone. Because of him. Inside his suit, Jack starts to shake. He's going to pass out, can already feel the blood draining out of his skull. Anita has her hands on her head, fingers knotted in her hair. She glances back towards the stairs, remembering that her sons are there, and moves towards them. Corey is sobbing, Malik staring in stunned, uncomprehending horror.
"Someone talk to me,"
Hannah says over the speakers. Her voice is no longer calm.
"What do we do?"
Everett says to Roman. The soldier shakes his head. Everett looks at him like he's gone insane.
"We have to help her,"
he says, speaking the words slowly, as if Roman is a child.
"It's too late for that." "Don't you dare say that! Don't you Hey!
Roman grabs Everett's shoulder.
"We can't do anything for her. She's got no pulse. Even if we were to relieve the pressure, even if she did somehow make it, we're talking major brain damage. We do not have time for this. Not when we need to be ready to go as soon as the other vessel shows up."
His tone softens, just a little.
"I'm sorry. I know this isn't what you want to hear right now, but if you don't get it together, none of this is going to work."
He looks at Jack.
"Are you five by?" "What?"
Irritation on Roman's face.
"Can you handle this?"
Jack doesn't know how to answer that. Terror doesn't begin to describe it. Dorinda was the only thing keeping him from breaking down completely, and now she's gone. If he'd checked Seema like he meant to. But he wouldn't have needed to if he hadn't got Volkova. It's too much. Is he five by? He can barely move. But at the same time, there's only one answer. The one Heck would have expected him to give. He's screwed up a lot of things in his life. Most, if he's totally honest with himself. And really, when has there ever been a better time to be honest, when they're all this close to ending up as fucking space debris? But he's not going to screw this up. He can't. Or if he does, it's not going to be because he got drunk or didn't work hard enough. It's not going to be because he forgot to do something. Lorinda, she deserved better than that. He's not responsible for everything that's happened to them. But he did make it worse. He can't do that anymore. He's got to pull it together.
"I'm five," he tells Roman. "Five by. Fuck you."
Chapter 59. Roman has always gone quiet before a mission. He'd used the few minutes before deployment, going over the briefing materials, gear checked and rechecked, infill points and exfil points. He'd withdraw into his own world, ordering his thoughts, putting everything in front of him like a field of neatly sown crops he could survey in a single glance. What he hadn't thought about, had never needed to, was that it only worked because every other operator around him was doing exactly the same thing. The dropship was always quiet. Nobody talked to each other. Just pure, clean focus. He can't do that here. Even before the events of the past 2 minutes, it was loud, too chaotic. He told the kid he'd help, gave him his word. But is he really about to do this? Betray everything that's kept him going? He makes himself look at the boy. His brother is lowering him to the stairs, having been told by his mom to head up to the cockpit to tell Hannah what happened. Corey's eyes meet Roman's. And he makes himself hold them.
"Do it for him. Him and Madhu."
Thinking of Madhu sets off the anger inside him, the tiny ball of hate pulsing in his gut. He ignores it, makes himself move, checks Jack's suit, running his fingers along the seams and the pack. Without even looking, he can feel something is wrong. He leans over Jack's shoulder, squinting at the data readouts on top of the pack.
We've got a problem.
What do you mean? Jack says, trying to twist his head to look where Roman is looking.
Here, he says, running his fingers along the neck seal. Your seal's torn, and the pack's readouts aren't right. I think something inside got jogged loose.
Can you fix it? Jack asks. I can, says Everett. He still looks like he wants to pass out, but he moves with purpose, striding across the bar.
Ev?
Anita checks Brendan's cuffs one more time, then springs after him.
What are you doing?
Roman frowns at him.
You've worked on suits.
No, but I'm good with my hands, if I can get inside.
Just let him do it,
Anita says, pointing to Roman.
He's the one going out there. We need to look after the boys. You...
Roman is about to tell her that he's no suit tech when Everett turns around and grabs his wife by the shoulders.
Anita, he says, you're the most brilliant woman I've ever met. You're great at your job, and you're an incredible mom. I love you and our boys more than life itself, and I wouldn't change it for anything. But right now, you need to let me work. You need to look after Corey and Malik and watch Brendan and let me fix this suit.
Ev!
Anita can barely form the word. She's crying now, tears running down to the corners of her mouth. He hugs her tight.
I know.
At that moment, Hannah's voice bursts through the speakers. This time, there's no disguising the raw panic in it.
Ship!
She says, shouting so loud that her voice distorts.
We've got a ship! Far away, but closing fast!
A ship, almost certainly the Victory. Hayes, tired of waiting for his team to return from their mission, decided to burn another jump core, figure out what went wrong. Rodriguez would be on that ship, his squadmate, the one whose fiancée had been blown to pieces at Bellatrix. Hayes had selected him as part of the backup team. Roman's mouth is suddenly very dry. It's not just his own revenge he's turning his back on here. What would Rodriguez do if their positions were reversed? Would he have gone down so easily?
I can't do this, says Roman.
What are you talking about?
Corey is staring at Roman like he's gone insane, tears still tracking down his cheeks. Everett comes to a halt, almost tripping on the stairs. Roman hangs his head.
You're asking me to betray my...
He can't finish. He was going to say friends, but that's not right. The people on the Resolute and on the Victory aren't friends in a traditional sense. They aren't even a unit, just a group of individuals with the same axe to grind. But he knows what every single one of them is going through, has felt it every day for the past decade. He can't turn on them. He can't. He looks over at Corey, as if the boy will have the answer. Corey just stares back at him, mouth slightly open.
We can't force you to choose.
Anita. She's gone to Corey, standing behind him, hands on his shoulders, chin raised ever so slightly. Her face is red and puffy, dark circles under her eyes, but her voice is steady.
But none of us were given a choice in this, either, she says. We made do. We figured it out. And you gave my son your word that you'd help us.
Her fingers tighten on Corey's shoulders.
So you need to choose. And you need to choose quickly, right now. Because if you don't, it's all over. For all of us.
For a few seconds, it's as if the scene in the bar is frozen in amber.
I'll hail them,
Roman hears himself say, heading for the stairs. Chapter 60 Hannah thought she had this under control. She'd done some basic thruster work with the panda, getting a feel for it, The tutorial was straightforward, easier than she expected, actually. It didn't stop a pool of sweat forming at the small of her back, or an ache spreading through her fingers, gripping the control stick. But she was fine, definitely fine. She knew something was happening in the bar, something bad. She could hear shouting, muffled thuds, but she didn't dare leave her post to find out what it was. And then she saw the other ship approaching her position, and everything she'd just learned went right out of her head. She doesn't know where it came from or what direction, but all of a sudden it was just there, hanging in the blackness beyond the destroyed gate, perhaps 2 miles away, although it's not like she's great at estimating distances out here, which may or may not be a problem when she actually tries to park this stupid ship in the bigger one's cargo bay. She can't pick out the details, but its albedo is just fine from here. She can see the shape, the distinctive fins, the entrance on the underside, probably no wider than the hole in the Sigma station that Volkova piloted them into, the one that had scraped the belly of the panda raw. How long do they have? Minutes? Less? Panic overwhelms her, terror keeping her glued to her chair. They need to get away. They have to. They'll go back to Sigma, hide in the hotel like before. Running footsteps echoing through the passage behind her. Anita and Malik appear, Malik still clutching his holocam. Everett is there too, breathless, his eyes wide. Roman comes in behind him, looking grim.
"Can you talk to them?"
Hannah says, pointing to the part of the control panel she thinks is the radio.
"Lorinda's dead,"
Anita says, speaking before she's even finished. Hannah turns her head to look at her, sure she misheard.
"How?" "Seema, she... but she wasn't..."
Anita rubs a hand across her face.
"She hit Lorinda hard, knocked her out."
Hannah's world turns blurry at the edges, like a bad signal. She's suddenly aware of every physical sensation. The sensation of her body on the pilot seat, the clammy sweat sticking her shirt to her skin, the textured grips on the control stick. Most of all, she's aware of her heart beating, a rapid pounding in her ears. They have to get out of here. This is all wrong. The dream comes rushing back. The metal ball approaching her parents' house, her mum and dad not even looking, waving to her as it casts a shadow across them. And hammering in time with the heartbeat. "Got lucky, Rook. Got lucky, Rook. Got lucky." Very deliberately, Hannah takes a breath. She counts to 4 as she inhales, holds it for a moment, then lets it go. She shifts on her seat, pulling her sticky shirt away from the back of the chair. Roman reaches past her, hands dancing across the panel.
"Victory, this is designated call sign Resolute, Delta 1830, Tango 6. Do you copy? Over?"
Nothing. No response. Not even static. Roman grunts, adjusting the frequency.
"Victory, designated call sign, Resolute, Delta 1830, Tango 6. Come in, over."
Still nothing. The Victory is approaching faster now. If the panda can't reach it, the spheres will release and they'll be finished. There's nothing they can do. How much time will be running by them? 10 seconds? Less?
"Victory, Resolute, please respond, over."
There's a burst of static from the cockpit speakers. Then a man's voice, thin but audible.
"Designated call sign Resolute, this is Victory, Alphas 3668, November 9er. We read you. What is your status, over?"
"Victory, Resolute. Our ship suffered a catastrophic jump drive failure. 2 of us managed to suit up and take command of a local vessel. Requesting extraction, over."
"Resolute, Victory. To whom am I speaking, over?"
"Victory, Resolute. This is Petty Officer First Class James Roman. I am here with..."
He trails off. Hannah glances over to him, even though it takes every effort for her to tear her eyes away from the approaching ship. He must be trying to think of which of his fellow soldiers to name, which identity to give Jack.
"I'm here with Petty Officer Third Class Lachlan Jacobs.
His suit is damaged, but we have a working one from this vessel. Requesting permission to enter Victory airlock. Over.
The speaker doesn't identify himself.
Resolute, Victory. Did you accomplish your primary objective? Over.
Anita mutters something. Hannah gives her a sharp glance, but it doesn't seem like whoever is on the other end heard it.
Victory, Resolute. This is confirmed. Primary objective achieved. Over.
A long pause.
Resolute, Victory. Roger that. We'll prepare the forward airlock for you, and then you're going to have one hell of a debrief. Victory out.
Roman stands up, pointing at the underside of the approaching ship.
The second those doors start to open, you move. Got it?
Hannah nods. She's been holding her breath and lets it go in a shaky burst. Roman ducks back into the passage.
What do we do?
Anita looks like she wants to complete whatever escape plan Hannah had in mind, but she doesn't move.
Nothing,
Hannah says, not looking away from the belly of the Victory.
Not yet.
And then she has an idea. She doesn't know if it's a good one, or if it'll even matter in the long run. She almost dismisses it. But after a few moments, she turns to Malik, still not completely sure what she's doing.
Hey,
she says,
could you do something for me?
Chapter 61.
Jack can barely move. How the hell did Lorinda do this for a living? How does anyone? Even with the assistance of the servos, every movement causes a fresh wave of sweat to burst out on his forehead. His suit feels like it's crushing the life out of him. When they first left the airlock, he thought his arms were going to be wrenched out of their sockets. He's tight behind Roman. The Victory has come to a stop a little over a mile away from their position outside the Panda. It blocks out a large part of the neb, a hulking, spiked shape. Lorinda's words.
Very short, very controlled burst on the thrusters. Everything you do out there is going to be magnified.
He tries not to imagine the people in the Victory watching them, or what they'll do if they decide that Jack's not who Roman says he is. He's not claustrophobic, but the helmet feels too tight on his head, the glass too close to his nose, the display too bright. He licks his lips, which are curiously dry, despite the humid suit interior. His armpits and lower back are clogged with sweat. Everything out here is bigger than him. Every single thing. Even the smallest piece of debris from the destroyed gate is a chunk that could obliterate him. He knows that probably isn't the case, that there are more than likely millions of tiny metal chunks dotted around them, but it sure as hell doesn't feel like it. He can't help but think of an old photo he saw once, taken back in the 21st century from a probe camera, a snap of the Earth from Saturn's rings. From that distance, the entire planet was a minuscule blue dot. You could cover it with the edge of a fingernail. He keeps looking for the red lights around the Victory's airlock. Can't see them. Not that it stops him. There's nothing to focus on out here. Nothing that isn't moving.
Careful. Debris below you.
Roman's voice crackles in Jack's ear, along with a tiny indicator blinking up on his display. Suit comms. He wasn't expecting it, and accidentally squeezes the forward thruster with his thumb. It sends him into a slow spin, his stomach feeling like it takes an extra second to follow. No biggie. All he has to do is correct it. He hits the backwards thruster, but holds it a split second too long, sending the spin into reverse. In a panic, he tries to give himself a little leverage with the stick, trying to play it, only for his spin to accelerate. He has to stop himself from reaching for the hem of his shirt. After so many years, the tick is automatic. But the slight movement of his hand somehow makes it worse. He's starting to spin faster now, the neb whirling away from him. What the hell are they doing out here? Humans were never meant to be in space. This is insane. An almost audible bump, felt more than heard in his helmet as he's brought up short.
Roman has pivoted, wedging both feet into the space below Jack's suit pack and firing his own thrusters to arrest their movement.
"Get a hold of yourself,"
the soldier hisses. Jack feels a sudden, irrational urge to scream. But, of course, it's way too late for that. He's right out on the edge, and the only person he can count on right now is someone who, a few hours ago, he was planning to torture for answers. He swallows, nods, forgetting for a second that Roman can't see the movement.
"Yeah,"
he says.
"Fine. Go easy on the damn thrusters. The old lady knew what she was talking about."
Jack feels another bump as Roman disengages. He tries to find the Victory again, and almost immediately sends himself into another spin. His gloves won't let him make precise movements. Even with the assistance of the servos, it's like he can't do anything but press hard, or not at all. The voice of the Victory's commander is suddenly in his helmet.
"Officers Roman and Jacobs, Victory Common Channel. This is Commander Hayes. We see that one of you is experiencing thruster difficulties. Do you need assistance, over?"
Before Jack can say anything, Roman is on the channel.
"Victory, Roman, that's a negative. Jacobs is in a civilian suit, and we think it has an issue with its feedback circuit. We're under control, over."
The ship slides into view. Jack backbursts hard on the thrusters, somehow bringing himself to a halt. Roman says nothing.
"Jacobs, Victory. One of my engineers tells me he can send a software package to your suit that might fix your feedback. Can you pull up the I.O. function on your HUD, over?"
At first, Jack doesn't respond, expecting Roman to do so. Then he realizes that Roman expects him to talk. And why wouldn't he? The Victory's commander contacted him directly. His mind shuts down. He has no idea how to respond. If they send that package, and he keeps having issues.
Victory Jacobs,
he says. Sweat blobs out in front of him, tiny balls of moisture bobbing in the low gravity.
"All five by here. I've got it under control."
He pauses.
"Over."
For a full 10 seconds, there's no response. Ahead of him, Roman coasts towards the Victory. The implication is clear, yet moving.
"Jacobs, Victory. Roger that. Proceed to airlock 2. Over."
Slowly, very slowly, the Victory begins to get larger. Jack finally spots their target, the red lights glowing above the airlock doors. Roman hasn't said anything since he last spoke to the commander, and the silence is starting to get to Jack. It's oppressive, thick, like a viscous liquid slowly filling up his helmet. All he can hear is his breathing, exaggerated and slow, but somehow ragged. At that moment, the launch bays on the side of the ship slide open. The bays holding the spheres. It makes his breath catch in his throat.
"Shit," he says.
"Jacobs, Victory. Say again, over."
The suit comms channel flashes up, and Roman, annoyed, says,
"What?"
"The..."
He almost points.
"The ball things. They're getting ready to fire."
They saw his spin. Worked out that he's not a space marine or whatever the hell these people are, and decided to finish the job the Resolute started.
"Relax,"
Roman floats into view.
"Probably just a precaution." "Precaution? Great. Against what?"
Roman doesn't reply. He fires his thrusters, coasting towards the Victory. Somehow, Jack manages to follow. The airlock doors are much bigger than those on the Panda, 15 feet across at least, with a trio of red lights along one edge. Jack has to work hard not to send himself into another spin as he approaches them, slowly bringing himself to a stop above Roman. Below him, he can just see the red Panda, hanging in the black. He follows Roman's lead, orientating himself so he's facing the correct way for the ship's gravity well to grab them. The doors open in silence, revealing a bright white interior module, angular and blocky. They coast inside, Jack's stomach lurching as the gravity well takes hold. God only knows how he managed to get himself the right way up. As it is, he lands on his feet, but can't keep himself there. He stumbles to his knees. They made it. Jesus Christ, they made it. Right now, it doesn't even matter that they're on an enemy ship. They're not outside. Suddenly, the suit feels way too tight. He claws at his helmet, fat fingers fumbling for the neck seal.
Wait!
Roman's voice is harsh, his hand heavy on Jack's shoulder. He points, and Jack sees a set of 5 more red lights above the inner door. As he watches, they start to go green, one by one. The airlock is pressurizing. If he'd removed his helmet before it did. And if the commander is there, or someone who knew the mysterious Lachlan Jacobs. The lights go green. Jack yanks his helmet off, gasping, and the noise of the Victory washes over him. Clanks, rumbles, a subsonic hum that he can feel in the pit of his stomach. It's the same noises as those on the Panda, but magnified, distorted. He's still on his knees. Roman, standing beside him, is pulling off his helmet. As he does so, the interior door opens. As it slides back, with the noise of the motor filling the airlock, Jack almost passes out. It's not just the fact that the EVA almost went horribly wrong. His mind is in overdrive, and for a second he sees a squad of soldiers behind the door, weapons up, ready to put 3 bullets into him, just like the Roses did with Hector. And if Roman hasn't turned on them yet, he will, the second he sees the other soldiers. Jack blinks. There's just one person standing there. A woman, with dark skin and black hair pulled back into a neat ponytail.
Roman?
She looks between them.
Jacobs?
There's no flare of recognition in her eyes when she looks at Jack, but no suspicion either, which is good. Her accent is subtle, Middle Eastern, Jack thinks. She's wearing a severe black jumpsuit. The muscular frame underneath it reminds Jack of Seema, and for a moment he can feel the latter's hands on his neck. Roman lifts his chin.
Roman here.
Mahmoud, she says. Medical officer.
Are we ready to jump?
Roman phrases the question casually.
Hayes wants to talk to you first. He says I gotta give you a once-over in the infirmary, then take you to his quarters.
Fair warning, he's not happy. Chapter 62. They've put Brendan back in the bathroom, still cuffed. Nobody knows what else to do with him, and nobody wants to risk having him loose. He fights them, harder this time, roaring his wife's name, but he's still too out of it. And restrained as he is, with both Everett and Anita holding his arms, he can't get away. Corey can't stop thinking of Lorinda. Her body is still behind him, stretched out on the floor. It doesn't seem real. He keeps expecting to look up and see her standing, a sheepish grin on her face.
Sorry, wasn't myself for a second there.
Take me upstairs.
Corey says, when Brendan is locked away, the boxes safely back in front of the door. His mom is on the verge of arguing, then thinks better of it. Malik is still up in the cockpit, but she and Everett scoop Corey up. Corey's teeth are gritted so hard that his jaw aches. They are finally out of nanomeds. He can't believe how fast they went. The big cat is feasting, but Corey knows that it won't be doing so for long. Either they make it, and he gets to have an actual doctor take a look at the break, or he won't have to worry about his leg anymore. As they round railings at the top of the stairs, Everett loses his balance, and Corey's foot jolts against the metal. The pain is so sharp and sudden that he sees stars, little prickles of light at the edge of his vision.
"Sorry, buddy," says his dad.
But he and Anita don't stop moving, turning sideways as they had in the passage. Corey gets one look past them at the main deck. The plastic seats, the scuffed floor, the badly hidden speakers in the ceiling, around the edge of the murky viewport. The strut on the wall that he lost his grip on after Captain Volkova killed the gravity. And as he takes it in, he gets the strangest feeling. He wants the panda to be okay. He wants it to fly again. Compared to the other ships Corey has on his posters at home, even compared to the ones Jamie designs, it's nothing. It's a tiny, boring little tourist ship. Low range, no weapons, and before Volkova avoided those metal balls by the destroyed gate, Corey would have said it had zero manoeuvrability. But it's kept them alive. Without it, they wouldn't be here. Please be okay. At that moment, he's not sure if he's thinking about them or about the ship. They push through into the cockpit, Anita and Everett setting him down gently. From his spot on the floor, Corey can't see much, but what he can see is the attack ship. It's close enough to make out the details now. The grey and orange paint, the rigid, spiky fins. Corey's breath catches in his throat.
"What are they doing?" his dad says.
Hannah doesn't look away from the Victory's cargo bay, still shut tight.
"I don't know. They went inside, though."
Anita and Malik lean over, obscuring Corey's view in the tight cabin.
"Shouldn't it be open by now?"
Anita says, trying to keep her voice even, failing miserably.
"Did they make it inside?"
"I just said."
"Then why?"
"I don't know." A silence falls on the cockpit. Corey watches as Hannah lifts her fingers from the control stick, flexes them, returns them to position. It's all down to her. Her and Jack and Roman. He's done everything he can. All they can do now is... The pain obliterates him. It comes on in a huge, searing wave, worse than anything he's felt before. He screams, clutching at his leg, wanting to hold it, not daring to. Through the tears doubling his vision, he sees his mom and dad exchange a horrified, desperate look. Malik is gripping his shoulder.
"It'll be okay,"
he's saying over and over, as if he's trying to reassure himself instead of Corey.
"There's got to be something," Everett says to his wife.
To Corey, it sounds like he's speaking from very far away. His mom shakes her head, her face pale in the cockpit lights.
"Nothing."
"But what if we—"
Anita ignores him, dropping to her knees in front of Corey, putting a hand on his cheek. It's slick with sweat, and he wants to tell her to take it away, but he can't get the words out. The cat bites harder, and he screams again. In her seat, Hannah flinches.
"Did I ever tell you how your dad and I got together?"
Anita says. Corey's face is dripping with sweat, but he manages to shake his head.
"You said you met in college."
Each word feels like it's being wrenched out of him.
"That's right, we did. But we never told you how."
She's trying to distract him. Corey wants to tell her not to bother. The only thing that's going to work is if he puts his head down and fights the cat, pushes it back, somehow. He tries to speak, but he can't get the words out. His shredded throat won't cooperate.
"Nita..."
Everett looks acutely uncomfortable.
"We said we wouldn't."
She ignores him, scooching in a little closer to Corey, putting out her other hand to grip Malik's shoulder.
"So while I was in college in California, I had a boyfriend. Not your dad, obviously. He was a nanochem major, and we were pretty serious."
"What was his name?" Malik says, glancing over at Corey, as if he, too, knows what his mom's doing and wants to help. She grimaces.
"Doesn't matter. But he wasn't a good guy. We were living together and he..."
A long moment passes. Corey expects to feel relief that she's stopped speaking. Instead, he finds himself desperate to keep listening. She was right. Anything is better than focusing on what's happening below his waist.
"He didn't hit me,"
Anita's voice is flat.
"But he was... well, I suppose you know what abusive means. He tried to control me."
She looks between her sons.
"We were walking down the street one day. It was in August. And I said something. I don't remember what it was, but it set him off."
She licks her lips.
"He starts yelling at me, right then and there, calling me names." "Who was he?"
Malik looks furious.
"Not important,"
Everett says, his voice barely a murmur. He's staring out of the cockpit glass at the other ship.
"And I'm crying."
Another lick of the lips.
"Because I don't know what to do. The street is crowded, and I knew I had to say something to make him stop, but I didn't know what. And nobody is even looking at us. He's just yelling these horrible things, and..."
She sniffs, the kind of wet sniff people make when they're about to cry and trying very hard not to.
"And then out of nowhere, your dad arrives. He wasn't exactly in the college where we were at. He couldn't get the financing, and you know, Grammy and Grandpa couldn't really afford it. So he was working as a..."
She closes her eyes, as if trying to remember.
"Lens repair tech," Everett mutters. "Lens repair tech, right. And he had a job nearby, and he saw what happened. He comes running up, trying to get between us. Just trying to calm my boyfriend down."
She puts a hand around her husband, drawing him close, the words rushing out of her now.
"So my boyfriend hits him, and then he starts to kick him. And I'm screaming at him to stop, but he's not, and nobody is even looking in our direction, and I was so scared."
Then she smiles. She actually smiles.
"And your dad, he's yelling, 'Leave her alone!' He's on the ground, getting beaten up, and he keeps telling the guy to leave me alone."
She wipes her face, crying openly now. Around them, the cockpit is utterly silent.
"Eventually, the cops did come and break it up. Your dad spent the night in hospital, getting pumped with every nano they could find." "And you got together after?"
Malik asks.
"Not right away. We stayed friends for a few months before he asked me out, and then it was still a few years before we actually got married. I had to convince him to come with me to Austin."
Finally, Corey's throat allows him to speak.
"Why didn't you tell us?"
In the quiet that follows, he's acutely aware of the three of them around him, huddled close.
"Because..."
Anita swallows, then sets her shoulders. She glances at her husband, as if to check he's okay with this, then says,
"Because we decided you didn't need to hear about your dad getting hurt, or your mom getting shouted at by..."
A great hitching sob bursts out of her. Everett pulls her close, and she buries her head in his shoulder, her body shaking.
"But you were going to get divorced,"
Mal says, with something like wonder. Everett sighs.
"We talked about it. The past couple of years have been tough." "But if you helped her,"
Corey hears himself say,
"then why?"
"Life takes weird turns sometimes, pal. Your mom and me, well, we had some things to work out. We're pretty different people."
"But even if it happened..."
Anita lifts her head off her husband's shoulder, her eyes red.
"I'd still love your dad."
Her voice gets fierce.
"I want you to know that. He helped me when nobody else would, and he gave me..."
It's a few moments before she speaks again.
"He gave me you two," she says. "He gave me my boys."
She pulls both her sons into a fierce hug, Everett folding on top of them, as if he can protect them from what's coming. Anita's voice is barely above a whisper.
I love you so, so much. All of you.
We love you too, Mom, Malik says. Corey doesn't know if she's right, and at that moment, with the cat's fangs digging into his leg and the bigger ship looming above them and their time measured in what might be minutes, he finds he doesn't care. Not one little bit. Chapter 63. For such an enormous ship, the Victory's medical bay is tiny. It's a windowless, rectangular room packed with equipment, taking up most of the floor space and climbing the walls to the ceiling. Jack sits on one of the room's three beds, blinking in the harsh white light. He doesn't dare move. Not until Roman does. Mahmoud might just be a medical officer, but it doesn't take a genius to figure out that she'd probably knock him on his ass in about half a second. In any case, even if he did get away, he wouldn't have the first clue where to go. What is he even doing here? He's supposed to be making sure that Roman doesn't betray them, and eventually helping him operate the jump gate. The second one he can probably do, maybe. But if Roman does turn on them, how exactly is he, Jack, supposed to stop him? There'll be no Lorinda with a shard of glass this time. No one to help. Lorinda. Jack has to force himself not to shiver. He looks over at Roman. They've still got their suits on, and Mahmoud is shining a light into the soldier's eyes.
Looks good, she says, clicking the penlight off. You're okay. You can take your suit off, by the way.
She half turns to Jack, then stops.
Roman? Yes.
Roman is working on his neck seal. For the first time, Mahmoud looks unsure.
When you were on the Resolute, did you know an officer named Reyes?
Sylvia Reyes? Roman stops moving. His voice is almost inaudible.
I did. Did she?
Mahmoud trails off. Roman shakes his head, very slowly, side to side. A wave of emotion rushes across the medical officer's face. She gets it under control, closing her eyes briefly, then turns to Jack.
Jacobs, she says, her voice barely shaking. Let's get you looked at. Any pains? Ringing in your ears? No.
Jack feels numb. Mahmoud looks into the middle distance, blinking as she activates something on her lens. When is Roman going to move? They're running out of time. The soldier is stepping out of his suit. He wears a black jumpsuit underneath it, with the same dagger patch on the breast.
I'm going to give you a shot of Oraxolone, Mahmoud says to Jack. We don't know what the rad protection was like on that civ suit of yours. You ever been dosed before? No, I don't think so. You sure? If you have, I'll need to adjust the amount. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I can look it up.
She blinks twice.
Okay, Jacobs, found you. Let's get you out of that suit and...
Mahmoud stops, frowning. She looks at Jack, blinks, blinks again. The frown changes, her eyes narrowing. And that's when Jack realizes what's happening. She's looking at a medical profile of the real Lachlan Jacobs. One with his photo. Before he can say anything, Roman moves. He wraps an arm around Mahmoud's neck, forcing her down to her knees and bending her backwards at the same time. She chokes, snarling, her training taking over as she attempts to wedge her hands under his arm. Jack sits, stunned, watching it happen, knowing he should help but not having the first clue how. In a move so fast that Jack almost misses it, Roman rocks back, then jabs three times at the base of Mahmoud's neck with his free hand. Her body goes limp, twitching, and she claws at his arm for a split second, before her hands slump to her side. Roman holds her for a few seconds more. Then slowly,
Almost tenderly, he lowers her to the deck. She's still breathing, her chest rising and falling.
Holy shit.
Jack can't think of anything else to say.
Get changed.
Roman looks like he wants to do to Jack what he did to Mahmoud, but now that she's down, he doesn't hesitate. He grabs her sidearm, a thick, chunky pistol with a textured grip. Then he does the strangest thing. He pinches his lens out, throws it away, then digs his fingertips into Mahmoud's rolled-back eye. With practiced ease, he slides her lens out, using it to replace his discarded one. He sees Jack looking.
Keyed to her weapon, he says.
He glances down at Mahmoud's unconscious body, a dark cloud crossing his face. Then he moves to the door.
Let's go.
Jack strips off his suit as quickly as he can. He has to work hard not to get caught on the tight seals. Then he follows, trying to ignore the shaking in his legs. He's got to focus. It's not just his life on the line here. He's letting the little things slip, letting the details get away from him. He can't do that, not now. Again, he sees Lorinda, pictures the bruise on her temple. Jack got to go on board a frontier military cruiser once, over 15 years before. It was back when he was first starting out as a reporter, way before he ditched that shit show for travel writing. The frontier, eager for some decent PR in the midst of the war, let a group of journalists tour one of its ships. He recognizes the style here. The corridors are functional, narrow, all gleaming metal and recessed pipes. What's missing are signs. On the cruiser he toured, there were directional markers everywhere, pointing to the mess hall, the engines, the bridge. There's nothing like that here. It's like the crew doesn't need them. Jack shivers again, jogging to keep up with Roman. Without him, he'll be lost, and then dead. The ship is deserted, or at least running with minimal crew. They walk in silence, Roman in the lead. His military jumpsuit has a slim-fit holster at the waist, and he tucks Mahmoud's gun into it. In the distance, Jack can hear a voice over the ship's speaker system, the words made inaudible by the twisting corridors. The ship's AI, maybe. Probably one a little more sophisticated than the brick-dumb computer on the Panda. Maybe it's even in control of those damn spheres.
Why'd you wait? Jack says.
Roman looks over his shoulder, annoyed.
Excuse me? With the doctor.
He searches for her name.
Mahmoud. You could have taken her down the second you were out of your suit. She would have figured out something was up anyway, the second she saw I was in civilian gear. So why did you wait?
Roman stops, hand moving unconsciously to his weapon, turning to face Jack. Against the bright lights in the corridor, he's a silhouette, his face in shadow.
Let's get one thing straight,
he says, his voice barely above a whisper.
I gave you my word that I'd help you. I'm going to honor that. But I didn't say how, and I didn't let you tag along so you could question my decisions. If you do so again, I'll put a bullet in your leg and drag you to the bridge. It won't stop you from helping me operate the jump gate. Okay, Jesus.
Jack raises his hands, trying to ignore his thudding heart. Then, before he can stop himself, he says,
Who the fuck pissed in your cereal?
It's an automatic response, something he'd say to Hector whenever his partner was in a foul mood. English wasn't Heck's first language, so he'd had to explain why someone might want to urinate in a bowl of soy flakes. It had become an in-joke between them. Heck had even started to say it to him, throwing it back in his face. God, he wants to see Hector right now. He would give anything to have him here. Not that it helps. He just trash-talked a special forces operative, one who 5 seconds earlier had threatened to shoot him. This is going so well. Roman doesn't shoot him. Instead, he does something Jack isn't expecting. He smirks.
Not very good at this whole teamwork thing, are you?
he says. Jack finds himself shaking his head.
Not really.
His voice is a croak.
Well, you'd better figure it out. It'll be a goddamn miracle if they don't shoot us the second we hit the bridge. So if you don't do exactly what I tell you, when I tell you, then we're fucked. Got it?
Without another word, he turns and resumes his march down the corridor. After a moment, Jack follows, trying very hard to stop himself shaking. Two corridors later, Roman says,
I didn't want her involved.
Huh?
You asked why I waited.
Roman doesn't turn around.
I thought there might be a way to leave her out of it. She might have let us go without checking and stayed in medical.
This time, Jack doesn't respond, and a few minutes later, they reach the bridge. It's a large room, with a wide, angled viewport along one wall, showing the Neb glimmering in the distance. The room is split up into three tiered levels, each with multiple workstations. For some reason, Jack expects the lighting to be dimmed. It's even brighter than the corridors, with banks of halogen bars along the curved ceiling. There are six crew inside, all of them wearing the same black jumpsuit as Roman. Two of them, a man and a woman, both of whom appear to be carved from granite, have the same dagger patch. They have their index fingers touching, their lenses linked, discussing what they're seeing in low voices. The rest of the crew are busy at their workstations. Jack and Roman enter through a side door on the middle tier. The first person to notice them is a bearded, slightly hunched man sitting at a workstation. He gives a tight nod when he sees Roman. His eyes land on Jack, and a frown crosses his face. It's as if he's sent up a signal flare. The activity on the bridge slows, the operators turning one by one to look at them. It's then that Jack sees the commander, Hayes. He's on the same level as they are, a big man, bald, perhaps early 50s, with broad shoulders and dark skin. His eyes, when he turns to look at them, are a dull grey.
Roman, he says, you were told to wait in my quarters. Did the doc...
He stops as he catches sight of Jack, takes in his clothing and the fact he's definitely not military. His face, already lined with wrinkles, gains a few more as his eyes narrow. Before Jack can even process what's happening, Roman takes three strides forward, pulling Mahmoud's pistol from its holster as he does so, the move smooth and controlled. Then he puts it against the commander's forehead. In every movie Jack has ever seen, there's a weird clicking sound any time someone raises a gun, like it's automatically cocking itself. The feed's film critic, a fat bastard named Hunnigan, with bad body odour and a terrible taste in shoes, once told Jack that it was a throwback to the old days of filmmaking, one that most directors still hadn't managed to get rid of, even though it's been a long time since anyone had to cock a gun. And yet, as every single soldier on the bridge pulls their own sidearm and aims it at Roman, he expects to hear it, those sinister, ratcheting clicks. Instead, it happens in virtual silence, with nothing but the rasp of metal on holster fabric. Somehow, that's even worse. They might be computer geeks and pilots and engineers, but he has no doubt that every single one of these people is just as deadly as Roman.
Everybody stay calm,
Jack says, his voice jumping a few octaves higher than normal. Around him, the bridge is quiet, nobody moving, nobody speaking, everybody focused on Roman and Hayes. It's as if he isn't even there. Hayes doesn't raise his hands, doesn't budge from his position. The expression of righteous indignation doesn't leave his face.
Lower your weapon, soldier. Everybody out.
Roman presses the point of the gun a tiny bit harder into Hayes's forehead. Jack's right hand is aching, and he realizes it's because he's clenching it, the nails digging into his palm. His left hand is on his shirt hem, twisting it tight.
What the fuck are you doing, Roman?
It's the guy with the dagger patch, a thick-set man with a chest-length beard. The hand holding his gun looks big enough to palm a watermelon. Another soldier, a slim woman with a tribal tattoo snaking up the neck of her jumpsuit, takes a step forward, her sidearm steady.
"Say the word, sir."
Roman doesn't look at her.
"Better be careful," he says.
His voice is a low monotone, his words coming quick.
"I'm on a hair trigger. Your aim's off by even a little bit. The sympathetic muscular contraction of my finger will discharge my weapon."
"Yeah, I did Q-course too, asshole!"
The woman sounds somewhere north of furious now.
"Hold!"
Hay's eyes flick to Jack, then back to Roman. And that's when Jack becomes aware of one or two of the guns swinging to face him. His bladder sends out a twinge, and it suddenly feels hot, too loose inside his gut.
"Think very, very carefully about this, Roman."
Hayes starts to raise his hands, moving very slowly. Roman jerks his head.
"I'm sorry, sir. No choice."
His next words are almost a shout.
"I'll say it again. Everybody out, right now."
Nobody moves. Not even the woman with the tattoo.
"Three count, then I pull the trigger," Roman says.
It's like every soldier in the room winds themselves a little bit tighter, gripping their guns a little bit more firmly. Jack feels like he's going to fall over. His bladder is throbbing now, sending up weak waves of pain. Maybe, if he can hold on long enough, they'll shoot him before he pisses himself. At least then he can die with some dignity.
"One."
Roman is dead still, eyes locked on the commander.
"Two. Wait,"
Hayes says. He raises his voice.
"Do what he says."
The female soldier snarls. Hayes's eyes flick to her.
"That's a direct order, Mazzini. Lower your weapon."
Mazzini's pistol wavers, then drops. One by one, the rest of them do the same.
"Yeah."
Jack licks his lips.
"All right."
He's not sure if he says the words out loud or just thinks them.
"Put your AI into recovery mode," Roman says. "I don't want it interrupting."
Hay's eyes narrow in anger, but then he says,
"Victory?"
The AI's voice comes over the speakers, crisp and efficient.
"Yes, Commander Hayes?" "Hayes, DF-789-8901. Transfer ship control to manual. Recovery." "Commander Hayes, I am detecting elevated stress levels in your voice and the presence of drawn weapons on the bridge. Do you want me to..." "Do it!" "Commander, I cannot comply. I have concluded that you are under duress." "Recovery mode, or I pull the trigger,"
Roman says.
"Victory. Hayes, DF-789-8901. My life is in danger if you do not enter recovery mode. Comply."
A long pause. Then,
"Entering recovery mode, Commander. System offline."
The next few minutes are a blur. The soldiers finally leave, filing out of the same door Roman and Jack entered through. They stand in the corridor, huddled together, weapons still pointed into the room. Roman directs Jack to lock all the other doors, giving directions without taking his gaze or his gun from the commander. As Jack fumbles with the keypad next to a door on the top level, he sneaks a look back. Hayes is refusing to look away from Roman, his mouth set in a thin, defiant line. When the other three doors are locked off, Roman slowly walks the commander back towards the open one. The soldiers in the corridor don't give way, and Roman has to bark at them to move.
"Last chance," Hayes tells him.
Roman jerks his head at Jack, not looking at him.
"Lock it down."
Jack does so, sweaty fingers slipping on the keypad. The door starts to close, and at the last second, Roman plants a hand on Hayes's chest and shoves, pushing the commander through. Hayes cries out, losing his balance, the look on his face switching to one of murderous fury.
Get!
He yells. Then the door closes with a loud click, cutting off the rest of the sentence.
We should have kept him, Jack says. Hostage.
This time, he's pretty sure that he spoke out loud, even if he's forgotten that Roman told him not to ask questions.
Can't hold a gun on him and operate the jump controls at the same time. Now let's get moving. We've got about 3 minutes before they cut their way back in.
He considers.
Unless they blow the door. What happens if they blow the door?
Roman says nothing. Chapter 64. Something's wrong, Everett mutters. Hannah doesn't reply. Her hands ache from holding the controls, but she doesn't dare let go, doesn't dare look away from the underside of the Victory, where the cargo bay is. Every time she blinks, it looks a little smaller. Everett shifts behind her.
It's been 20 minutes. Can we contact them somehow? Radio or...
No, Dad!
Corey sounds breathless.
It's like I told you.
Just give them time, Anita says. And still Hannah says nothing. She's thinking about Rainmaker and Blackbird and Omen. She never got to see the end of the historical sim, never found out if they made it or not. She distracts herself by running through what she learned in the tutorial, remembering the AI's instructions. And still she can't pull herself away from that battlefield, the images invading her thoughts.
It's open!
Anita's voice is urgent. When Hannah doesn't respond, she hits her in the shoulder.
Hey! It's opening up!
Hannah blinks. A mile away, the Victory's cargo doors are opening. A thin black line, growing wider by the second. And then, from inside the gap, a light flickers on, shining out of the ship's belly.
They did it!
Malik says, his voice curiously high-pitched.
Go!
Everett says.
Go, go!
Hannah doesn't even wait for him to finish speaking. She punches the thrusters, and behind her, the Panda's engines rumble into life. Slowly, very slowly, the other ship starts to grow in the viewport. They aren't moving nearly as fast as they did when Volkova was in the pilot seat. She must have known some tricks to coax more thrust out of the engines. All the same, the Panda is accelerating, its puny engines pushing it closer and closer to the Victory. Hannah reminds herself to breathe, flexes her fingers on the controls. She's staring at the other ship so hard that she has to remind herself to blink. A minute ticks by. Another.
Easy.
Everett breathes. He's right in her ear, and she jumps, only just managing not to knock them off course.
Sorry,
he tells her, backing away. Behind him, Anita lets out a long, shaky breath. Hannah returns her hands to the controls. They're getting close, the gap in the Victory's underside growing bigger by the second. It's a little above them now, drifting towards the top of the viewport. Okay, not a problem. Exhaling, Hannah very gently tweaks the stick. And almost immediately realizes she isn't ready for this. From a distance, across a mile of open space, she could keep the Panda steady. But with the Victory on top of them, every movement she makes is suddenly too much. She's trying to line up the slow, ungainly, oversteering Red Panda with a very narrow space, and she just can't get it to do what she wants. The Victory drifts away from her, and she has to yank the stick back, too hard, the ship swinging in the other direction. She tries to calm herself, tries to think of her parents, of their house, of the museum job she's going to have, of the life she's going to lead. It's all a blur. Terror has smudged her mind, the images mixing with the ones she saw in the VR sim.
Guide, says Volkova, your movements are erratic. Do you wish the ship to return to autopilot?
No,
Hannah hisses through gritted teeth.
Go left, Malik says. Hannah tweaks the stick. But when the panda doesn't respond fast enough, she pushes too far, oversteers. The Victory drifts too far, the cargo bay sliding past, Hannah correcting again, fingers locked on the stick, hoping, praying the ship will do what she wants. Everett by her ear.
You're too far over.
Yeah, Hannah says through gritted teeth.
Let me see,
Corey yells from behind her.
You gotta slow down, Malik says. You're gonna hit the side. Pull up.
And then everyone is yelling the words. Hannah yanks the stick as hard as it'll go, the wall of the larger ship looming in front of her. She squashes back into her seat, as if it'll give her some extra protection from the impact. There's no way they're going to miss. They're too close. Anita screams as the belly of the panda scrapes the Victory's hull. The tall ship shudders, an alarm blaring somewhere, but Hannah barely hears it. She's still pulling the stick into her stomach, as if they'll crash the second she eases up. They've lost sight of the Victory. The Neb glares at her. She's breathing too fast, panic clawing at her throat.
The captain did this for 12 years. You've been doing it for 12 minutes. You're never going to make it.
When the panda completes its loop, the Victory is just visible, down at their 6 o'clock. They'll never get into the cargo bay from here. To do so, they'll have to fly alongside the ship's hull, then hard turn left into the tiny space. Not a chance. Willing the little ship to go faster, Hannah turns them around, tracking them away from the Victory, lining up another run. The attack ship hangs in front of them, daring her to try. The stick is juddering in her hands. It wasn't doing that before. Is it her imagination, or is the panda moving even more slowly than before? She flashes back to the grinding they felt when the ship tagged the Victory's hull. What if something got damaged? What if...
Mel, I can't see!
Corey shouts. Everett, far too loud. Go again! It's okay! Anita.
Malik, sit down!
Hannah finds the thrusters, trying with every atom in her body to line them up right. But the tiny dot of the cargo bay is swinging around, dancing across the viewport. The Victory gets bigger and bigger.
They're going too fast.
Hannah tries to decelerate, and the panda's response is barely there, sluggish and lazy. If she's off target, they won't be able to pull up in time.
Slow down!
Everett sounds even more panicked than she feels.
Slow down!
She pulls the thrusters back. The panda refuses to slow down. The forward and aft thrusters have quit on them, either damaged by the scrape against the bigger ship's hull or not getting the power they need. Hannah tweaks the stick. They can still move left and right, but she can't drop their speed. In her mind, she sees the missiles arcing towards Rainmaker's Scorpion fighter, the gap closing. Her eyes track to the tiny cargo bay opening, swinging wildly in the viewport as she tries to line them up.
Thread the needle, she whispers. Come on, baby, thread the needle, thread the needle.
What?
Says Anita.
What are you? Shut up, I'm threading the needle.
She's drifted too far down again, has to correct. They're 200 meters from the Victory, so close that Hannah can see inside the cargo bay. It's a mess of strapped-down crates and loading machinery, a wide-open space that doesn't look quite big enough to take the panda. It's not going to work. They're going to get jammed in there, or bounce right off. And yet, she keeps going. Something beyond her understanding keeps her in her seat, keeps her playing the ship. 100 meters now, the door almost open, the entire cavernous cargo bay revealing itself. Anita abandons the viewport, dropping to her knees, pulling her sons and her husband in close. Hannah closes her eyes.
Chapter 65. The bang shatters the universe. It splits Hannah's skull in two, knocks her out of her seat. She has half a second to wonder why she didn't think to strap in. When she slams shoulder first into the control panel. Any second now, the panda is going to rupture, and it'll all be over. But then she hears another sound. A grinding, wrenching screech of tortured metal, as if the panda's very skin is being torn off. Before she can comprehend it, the sound vanishes as abruptly as if someone turned off the light bulb, as if...
we made it through.
Before she can process this thought, she becomes aware of a frantic, urgent beeping.
"Guide," says Volkova, sounding maddeningly calm. "Pressure loss imminent."
Hannah doesn't get a chance to react, because right then she looks up through the viewport. The gravity well has them. They're skidding across the floor of the bay, heading for the far wall, a vertical slab of metal, covered with handholds and terminals. Big, spray-painted stencil letters run across it, words reading, "Operators must maintain full suit pressure at all times." There's a loading exosuit in front of them. The panda sweeps it aside, shuddering, screaming as the suit tears chunks out of its hide.
"Everybody hold!"
Hannah shouts. Before she can finish the sentence, the panda collides with the wall of the cargo bay. For a second time in as many days, Hannah blacks out. It's the beeping that brings her round again, the pressure loss warning. She's hanging off the chair, legs twisted to one side, and her neck feels like someone has been hitting it with a claw hammer. She can't turn her head. When she tries, the pain squeezes tears out of her eyes. The panda is still moving, turning in a slow spin, the energy from its impact spent. Cracks have spread across the cockpit viewport. Beyond them, the cargo bay door is visible, sliding out of view as the ship spins. The door is just beginning to close. In a daze, she reaches for the control panel, trying to shut off the beeping sound. Her hand is a useless slab of meat, her fingers feeling 10 times larger than they normally are. There's nothing more they can do. They're inside. The ship is still intact, for now. And the moment that door closes, Roman and Jack will activate the jump gate. Volkova's voice reaches her ears.
"Guide, ship integrity has been compromised."
Hannah doesn't have time to think about it. She twists round in her seat, moving her head without thinking. The pain this time nearly makes her black out again, so she forces herself to move her body instead, actually lifting her right leg to get it out from under the control panel. The Victory isn't moving. If they jump, there won't be any transfer of momentum. They'll drop right in, but it'll be a big bump when they land, and if they're not strapped in, they'll be smashed to pieces. If they don't lose pressure and decompress first. The Livingstons are slowly picking themselves up. Everett is helping Anita with one hand, reaching out for his older son with the other. Corey Livingston is unconscious, his eyes closed, his head twisted at a strange angle. It's only when he shifts slightly, turning his head back, that Hannah realizes she's been holding her breath.
"The escape pod," she says.
Anita stares at her through bleary, shocked eyes.
"What?" "We have to get to the escape pod."
Unlike the seats on the main deck, the pod chairs have thick safety straps crisscrossing them and angled head supports.
"You guys take Corey. I'll get Brendan."
"But it won't help." Hannah can barely hear Malik over the insane beeping. "We can't launch it in here."
"We don't need to launch it."
She propels herself to her feet, forcing her body to do what she tells it. Her hand lands on something hard and spiky, the reptar figure, lying on its side on the floor. Moving her head more than half an inch in either direction is agony.
"We just need the seats."
"The seats?
We gotta strap in."
Hannah hurdles Corey, wanting to help, knowing that she needs to get to Brendan. As she charges down the passage to the main deck, she can hear the beeping following her, the warning that, at any second, the hull might give way, turning the panda inside out in under a tenth of a second.
"Hold on, little ship. Just hold on."
Chapter 66.
"They're in."
Jack smacks the heel of his palm against the control console.
"They're in."
Roman grunts, He's at the opposite side of the bridge from Jack, entering the jump coordinates into one of the workstations. He's already pointed out the one that Jack needs to look after, the one to do with matter shielding. He tried to make the instructions for Jack as simple as possible.
Control the drift in the bubble using the two sticks below the display. Reticle in the center.
God knows if the bastard is going to be able to follow them. It's a miracle he didn't get them killed on the crossing. How long has it been since they took the bridge? A minute? Two? Hayes and the other soldiers haven't blown the door, but there's plenty of noise on the other side of it. Either they're assembling the charges, or they're going to cut the door off at the point where it slides into the wall. Roman looks over at Jack's screen, which is showing the inside of the Victory's cargo bay. The Panda is a wreck, its hull smashed and scarred. The cargo bay doors are only just starting to close. That's when he hears it. A crackling sizzle, like a hot frying pan dumped into a sink of cold water. Hayes and his team are cutting their way in, the torch parting the door along one side, a thin line of hot metal spitting sparks.
"Almost there!"
Jack shouts to Roman. At that moment, a voice comes over the speakers in the ceiling.
"Roman, this is Hayes."
The speakers give his voice a very slight echo, deepen it.
"I am giving you a direct order to surrender, you and the civilian. This is the only warning you will get."
"Whatever, fuckstick," Jack mutters.
"You should know," Hayes says. "I've sent my engineers down to astronautics. I've ordered them to manually restart the ship's AI. I don't know what's gotten into you, son, but you are about 10 seconds away from losing it all. You understand me?"
The cargo bay doors have closed, the light above them turning green. Jack yells in triumph, slapping the console, then turning and dashing over to the workstation that controls the matter shielding.
"We're good," he shouts. "Do it, Roman. Jump."
Roman moves his hand towards the command option on screen and stops. He can still finish the mission. There's nothing to say he can't still have his revenge. He can work something out with Hayes. The civilians will be a problem, but they don't need to be killed. They can be held prisoner, kept out of the way until it's all over. He can't help but see Madhu and Brigitte and everyone else on the outpost. The rage flares up inside him. What is he thinking? He is a soldier, and this is his mission, and he has to finish it.
"No, you gave Corey your word."
"What are you waiting for?"
Jack yells at him. The cutting line is almost halfway to the bottom of the door. One way or another, he's going to betray someone. He either lets Corey down, Corey and every other civilian on that ship, or he lets down the people who raised him, Madhu, Brigitte, everyone on Cassiopeia, not to mention every one of his squadmates on the Resolute.
"Roman,"
Jack says.
"I can't."
And slowly, Roman lifts Mahmoud's gun and points it at Jack's chest. Chapter 67. Jack's hands go up. It's a reflex action, out of his control. What he really wants to do is dive for cover, but his legs have stopped listening to him, and his bladder has started to send out another round of warning signals.
"I'm sorry,"
Roman says, walking slowly towards Jack. The gun hardly shakes at all. For the second time, Jack tries to speak, can't do it, but there's a stupid look on Roman's face, determined and apologetic at the same time, and it's that finally makes him open his mouth.
"Come on, we don't have to."
He can't form sentences, can't even form thoughts. He takes a step towards Roman, his legs moving on their own.
"You don't understand. I can't do this to them."
"To who?"
Jack almost screams the words, has to remind himself that Roman has a gun on him, and probably still has that hair trigger. Behind him, the cutting torch stops. A foot from the bottom of the door, the wielder adjusting his or her aim. They've got maybe 20 seconds.
"I have to finish it,"
Roman says, looking at Jack, but sounding as if he's talking to himself.
I finish it and everything will be fine.
No, it won't. It won't, Roman. Listen to me.
You don't understand.
Sure I do.
Jack is nodding furiously. They're closer now, no more than 5 feet apart. He knows if he gets too close, Roman will pull the trigger, but he can't think of anything else to do.
I know that there are people on that tour ship who are depending on you. You told them you'd help them.
No, I'm sorry.
The cutting torch starts up again, tracking towards the bottom edge of the door. The jump coordinates Corey gave them are still up on the screen. Below is a touch box displaying the words, Jump Core Ready. Either Roman forgot to disable it or doesn't think there's any point. Not that it matters. There's no way Roman is going to let him get close to the terminal.
You gave him your word, he says. Corey, the kid, you promised you'd help him. We trusted you.
Don't talk to me about...
You want to shoot me? Go ahead!
Jack is babbling now, not even sure of where he's going with this, just knowing he has to do something.
If it'll help you get right with your commander, then it's okay. I know I deserve it.
He swallows hard.
I let the captain die. Lorinda, too. She's on me. I didn't check to see if Seema was dead, and maybe I should have. So go right ahead and do it. But the people on the Panda...
He points to the screen, still showing the tourist ship.
They don't. Don't make them pay for our fuck-ups. They deserve to go home.
Roman's fingers flex on the gun's grip.
That's enough.
You know who didn't keep their word? The goddamn Frontier. They were supposed to protect us. You want to be like them? These are the people you want to fight with? They're doing the right thing.
Roman all but snarls the words.
We're doing the... No, you're not.
A word explodes into Jack's mind. An old one, a familiar one. One he always thought he could depend on.
No ethics, he roars at Roman. You've got no ethics.
Roman's face creases in confused anger.
What are you talking about?
The bridge door is blown inwards into the room. As it happens, Jack whips his still raised hands forward, as if bringing them together in a clap. The heel of his right palm strikes the inside of Roman's wrist, the other, the back of the hand holding the gun, just like Hector taught him. Roman pulls the trigger. If Jack hadn't yanked his head to the side, it would have come clean off. As it is, the gunshot occurs right by his ear, so loud that it's as if his head really has exploded. He pushes through it, driving forward with his shoulder. Roman almost stops him. Jack hasn't built up quite enough momentum, but he's a little off balance, and Jack slides past his right side. Jump Corps ready. As the soldiers charge into the room, guns up, Jack sprints towards the terminal, hand outstretched, fingers brushing the screen. There's a sound, like the world's biggest engine hitting the red line. And then Jack's vision blurs at the edges. His hand leaves an afterimage in the air, hanging, ghost-like, over the console. Before he even understands what he's doing, Jack is turning, moving towards the screen he started at. If he doesn't center them inside the warp field, they'll tear apart. He can't count on Roman to do it, and there's every chance the soldiers will cut him down before he gets there. It doesn't matter. He's done all he can. No human has ever seen the space around the ship during a jump. Any camera on the hull, even ones designed to pick up light outside the visible spectrum, comes back with nothing but darkness. For the most part, jumps are as calm and uneventful as a drive across a deserted highway. Not this one. This one nearly shakes Jack's bones out of his skin. The engine sound blocks out everything, so loud that it feels like his very eyeballs are vibrating. The entire bridge is shaking, the shutters groaning. And yet every move he makes feels slow, like he's mired in molasses. His vision is doubled, tripled, strange light flashing in and out at the corners of his eyes. He can see the screen, see the two control sticks. It's all right in front of him, and a million miles away. As he finally, finally reaches the console, his vision quits on him. For 2 or 3 seconds, or what feels like 2 or 3 seconds, there's nothing but darkness. Panic seizes him, but as soon as it does, he can see again. Like nothing happened. He grabs the control sticks, holds on for dear life, trying to focus on the display. Keep it in the center. That's what Roman told him. He can't see the reticle. He knows it's there, just in front of him, but the screen appears to stretch as he looks at it, expanded to the size of a city block. Around him, the Victory bucks and writhes, a toy in the grip of a giant. He yells Roman's name, but the only thing that answers him is static. He can't see the soldier, or any of the others, doesn't dare turn to look. What comes next is very simple. If Roman doesn't uphold his end of the deal, they'll never make it. He spots the reticle, a tiny green circle. It's way too close to the edge of the display, still moving, inching towards it. With a dim horror, he realizes that he doesn't know which stick to use. He didn't think to ask. He doesn't waste time debating it, pulling hard on both sticks. The reticle slows, stops, and starts to drift again. But before Jack can do anything, it's gathering speed, zipping across the display, vanishing into the distance, coming back, the world bending in strange directions, the reticle appearing at the opposite end of the display, even closer to the edge than it was before. There's a tearing sound, the engine threatening to rip itself apart, the bridge around him coming to pieces. With what feels like every ounce of strength he has left, Jack pulls the sticks back. The reticle swings in a wide circle, doubling back on itself, tracking towards the center. Jack gives a triumphant yell, only to have it turn into one of horror as a vibration rips him away from the screen, sending him hurtling across the bridge. As he stumbles away, he sees the reticle nearing the bottom edge of the screen. The final vibration is the largest of all, large enough to tear a hole in existence.
Chapter 68. The problem with living out near the edge of Austin is that there are only so many kids to be friends with. If they aren't around, if, for example, one was on a family trip to Sigma and the other one had got himself grounded for some dumb reason or another, Ali Sultan couldn't remember what, there wasn't a whole lot to do. She'd already read every book in her room, flicked through the feeds of the people at school. Boys, boys, girls, holiday shots, stupid little animation meme thing, boys, ridden her hoverboard up and down the dusty street. Now she sprawled in her front yard on her back, running her fingers through the dirt, looking up into the orange sky, watching the contrails of shuttles taking off from the downtown spaceport. The house she lives in with her dad is a modest two-bedroom, a new-style light brick build, with its own recycler unit and a bottom floor entirely taken up with a large garage space. Other, identical houses close in tight on all sides, but round the back, open fields run all the way to the boundary fence of the vast mine dumps. The creek bed, long since dried up, is just visible from her bedroom window if she really craned her neck. That was where she got the gnarly scar on her forehead, from that time she and Corey and Jamie built that ramp. The scar peeks out from under her hairline, a jagged zigzag. She doesn't mind it. She thinks it looks kind of cool, even if it did take ages for the swelling to go down. Ali is a short girl, dark-skinned, with slightly pudgy upper arms that she says are muscle, but which Jamie refuses to stop calling wobble fat. Ali punches him on the shoulder every time he says it, and by now she's convinced the bruise is more or less permanent. She's wearing a pair of skate shorts and an old tank top, her favourite. She doesn't mind it getting messy. Without really thinking about it, she lifts a fistful of dirt and chucks it into the air. It's caught by the hot breeze, swirled away. She watches it go, her boredom getting heavier by the second. She's got to do something about this. Maybe she can take the monorail over to Lagos Square. She's not supposed to go there by herself, and even when she goes with Jamie and Corey, she has to beg her dad to let her. But maybe he'll be nice about it this time. She could phone up Lee from school, get her to come. They don't hang out much, but if Ali paid for the mono passes... As she sits up, her ears pop. It's a strange sensation.
like the inside of her head is filling with water, changing the pressure. She puts a finger in her right ear, trying to open it up, knowing it never works, but not sure what else to do. A second later, the sensation comes again, and this time it's so intense it actually hurts. Ali winces, getting to her feet. The air feels too still, the wind gone. Is it a storm? They get those sometimes, and they have to hide in the basement shelter that every house in Austin has to have by law. But there are no clouds in the sky, no hint of moisture. Her ears pop for a third time, insistent, making her blink in surprise. Ali doesn't quite understand what happens next. She's looking towards the mine dumps, not really seeing them, more concerned with the strange feeling in her head, when the sky goes hazy. It looks like the air just above the surface of a road on a really hot day, only it's everywhere. There's another pop, this one much louder, and it's coming from outside her head. Then, boom! The sound is one of the loudest she's ever heard, louder than a bomb. Half a second later, she's knocked head over heels by what feels like a tsunami of wind. There's a huge, distant crash and a hissing rush as staggering volumes of dirt are displaced. She rolls, arms flailing, yelping in shock. Behind her, the houses shake and shudder, threatening to tear loose from their foundations. Ali comes to a halt, dust swirling around her, coating her hair and face. There's something suspended above the mine dumps, something that wasn't there before. A black shape, dropping towards the ground. And at the edges of the shape, a glowing green corona of energy, spreading out like ripples in a pond. It hits the ground, knocking several of the hills flat, sending up a giant mushroom cloud of dust and almost blowing out Ali's eardrums a second time with the impact. The air is suddenly filled with dust and dirt, the clear sky turning hazy. Ali sits up, blinking. Her eyes are bright spots on a face caked with dirt. The house has turned red, the white light brick coated in thick dust. Ali sticks out her tongue, tastes dust in the air. By the time she gets to her feet, the sirens have started.
"Dad," she calls, "I think you'd better come out here."
Chapter 69. The first thing Corey Livingston sees is a red star. It drifts in front of him, lazy, too bright to look at directly. He tries to push away, knowing what it means, knowing what will happen if it gets too close to him. But when he tries to raise his arm, someone holds it down, the pressure gentle but firm.
"Easy," a woman's voice says. "Not quite done yet."
The red star is still there. It coaxes up memories from the darkness of his mind. Sigma, the red panda, the gate, Captain Volkova, Jack, Hannah, Lorinda, Roman. Corey tries to sit up, wanting to talk, unable to get the words out. His throat is parched. The red star is a tiny light on a robotic arm. The arm is hovering over him, making small, precise moves. It's as long as a man's, with a boxy cutting laser at its head. The arm turns towards him, and Corey flinches.
"Easy," the voice says again. "Take it slow. Your leg is going to be just fine, but we're not done yet, okay?"
Slowly, the space resolves itself. He's in what looks like a hospital room. Clean white walls, neutral tile pattern on the floor, bright lights. The robot arm is attached to a large, mobile control unit parked by the bed, with two more arms hanging limp at its side. His lower half is covered with an opaque, curved shield, blocking his legs from view. There's an opening in the shield, a little further down, and as Corey watches, the arm dips into it, the laser humming to life. He can't feel a thing. There's a woman by the bed whom he doesn't recognize. She's young, maybe in her 20s, with long brown hair and clean blue hospital scrubs.
"Broken bones," she says.
As she does so, she looks over at something across the room, something that makes her crease her brow in a frown. "Plus you'd really done a number on your tibialis anterior," she says, sounding distracted.
"Nanos are fixing that right up."
"Where am I?" Corey says. She blinks at something on her lens. Corey feels the bed rise underneath him, lifting the top half of his body upwards.
"Austin City General," she says. "East Wing. Now, we've numbed everything below the waist, so you won't feel anything for a little."
"Thank you, nurse," says a voice from across the room.
"That'll be all."
From his position on the raised bed, Corey looks over. There's a man sitting by the window, a man who looks familiar. He's in his 60s, clean-shaven, with salt-and-pepper hair and a friendly face. He's wearing a dark suit and a red tie, and as he meets Corey's eyes, he gives him a big, wide smile.
"Welcome back to the land of the living," he says.
"Senator," says the nurse, "I'm not sure this is the best for—"
"Oh, Mr. Livingstone here will be just fine."
The man raises a hand as if taking an oath.
"He's a tough one, and I promise, if there's any problem at all, I know where the call button is."
He winks at Corey.
"Spent a day here last year. I was riding my bike and took a fall. Try the chocolate pudding, by the way. It looks nasty, but it's really good."
"Yeah," Corey says, nodding in agreement, though he has no idea why. The man looks familiar, although he can't place him yet. The nurse wavers, then nods. "All right." She puts a hand on Corey's shoulder. "You're sure you're up to it?" In a daze, Corey nods again. The nurse tells him she'll be close by, and then makes her way out. The robot arm retracts from its position over his legs, whirring and clicking, and a section of the shield slides shut. Suddenly, Corey remembers where he knows the man from.
"You're my mom's boss."
"Indeed I am."
The man's accent is thick Southern Texas.
"Tom Daniels, it's great to finally meet you, Corey. Your mommy's told me a lot about you."
Corey says nothing. Part of him is still convinced that he's back on the Red Panda, that all of this is a dream.
"I'm glad you made it out,"
the man says, clapping his hands on his knees and rising to his feet. He walks over to stand by Corey's bed. He's taller than Corey first thought, with the big shoulders of a football player.
"Sounds like you had quite an adventure."
Yeah. I mean..."
Corey's eyes suddenly go wide.
"My mom! My dad! Are they—"
Daniels lifts his hands.
"Fine. They're fine. A little beat up, but no permanent damage. They're here, too. I haven't seen them yet, but the nurses tell me they're all okay. That's one hell of a landing you folks pulled off."
"Can you call them?"
Corey can't believe the relief flowing through him. They made it. They made it.
"In a minute. Something we gotta hash out first."
With a grunt, Daniels reaches behind him, pulling the chair across the floor. It makes a screeching sound that hurts Corey's ears. The senator sits down in it, breathing a sigh of relief, as if being on his feet had tired him out. Corey watches him, suddenly wary.
"Now, Corey," Daniels says, "you'll probably have a lot of people wanting to talk to you about all this. Feed reporters, your friends, folks you meet at the grocery store, and my guess is you'll want to tell them quite a story."
He gives Corey another kindly smile.
"But I wanted to ask you, as someone who knows your mommy pretty well, I wanted to ask you to keep things to yourself for now."
"Why?"
"Well,
It's a little complicated.
Daniels folds his hands in his lap.
A lot of people died out on Sigma. I'm sure you probably know that. We have to figure out who they all were and tell their families. And we don't know exactly what happened either, why the station got attacked like it did.
But we do.
Corey tries to sit up higher, wincing as he finally feels a thin darning needle of pain wind its way up from his leg.
One of our own ships.
I know.
Daniels isn't smiling anymore.
We're aware the ship you came in on was one of our projects. We're going to be looking closely at this whole situation to make sure it never happens again. But if you go telling everybody about it before we do, people will jump to conclusions. It'll hold things up at our end, make it harder for us to figure out what's what.
He lowers his voice, and Corey has to strain to hear him.
You understand what I'm saying? I need you to be strong for me now, Corey.
Daniels leans in.
I need you to tell this to your mommy and your daddy and your friends Hannah and Jack and your brother. I'll be talking to them, too, but I need you to back me up on this. It's really important. Can you do that for me? Can you?
From the door, Anita Livingston says,
Get away from our son!
Corey's head turns so fast that he almost strains a muscle in his neck. His mom and dad are striding into the room, his mom in the lead. She's got a massive black eye, and there are stitches on her lower lip. But she's okay. She's okay. His dad looks just as beat up, limping slightly. It makes Corey think of the story his mom told them, of how they met. Both of them, Corey sees, are wearing blue hospital gowns. And behind them, Malik, and Hannah, and Jack. All of them. Corey's joy fades when he sees the expression on his mom's face. He's never seen her this angry. In seconds, she's between Daniels and the bed, his dad too. The senator steps back, giving them room. They're all messed up. Jack's arm is in a sleek white cast, and Hannah is wearing a thick neck brace. With a start, he realizes Roman isn't there. Did he make it? Is he in the hospital? Malik appears on the other side of the bed, staring in horror at the shield over his brother's leg. He seems okay, even if he looks a little lame in the thin gown he's wearing. Before Corey can ask about Roman, he says,
They fix your leg? You gonna be okay?
His voice is breathless, almost panicked.
I think so,
Corey says. Malik wavers for a second. Then all but throws himself on top of his brother, pulling into a huge, rough hug. Corey wants to ask about Roman, but Malik is hugging him so hard that he can't speak.
They took my hollow,
Malik says, his words muffled by Corey's shoulder.
I don't know where it is.
For some reason, that scares Corey more than anything. And there's so much he wants to know. Not just about Roman. What happened to the other two attack ships? Where's Brendan? What's going to happen to him? Thinking of him and Seema makes Corey think of Lorinda and Volkova, and he feels a knife twisting in his gut. He's brought back when he hears his dad's angry voice.
Don't you ever talk to our kids,
Everett says.
Not ever. Understand me?
Anita,
Daniels says, smiling broadly.
Mr. Livingstone, and this must be Malik.
He looks over at the other two.
And let me see, Miss Elliot and Mr. Tennant, right? I'm Tom Daniels. It's a pleasure to...
We know who you are,
Hannah says. There's no warmth in her voice. She walks around to stand next to Everett, forming a protective wall between Corey and the senator. Jack starts to fold his arms, forgetting that one is immobilized. He does it anyway, jamming the free arm in awkwardly.
Well, that's good.
Daniels doesn't seem bothered by Hannah's tone.
and I'm glad you're all here. I was just talking to Corey about the need for discretion.
Discretion!
Jack says the word like it tastes bad.
Indeed. The senator rocks on his heels, clasping his hands behind his back. There needs to be a full Senate inquiry, and until that's been completed, I want to be sure we're all on the same page regarding speaking to the feeds.
He turns to Jack.
I'm afraid that includes you, Mr. Tennant. You'll need to...
Cut the shit,
Jack says. The room falls silent.
You ordered the attack on Sigma Station,
Anita says.
You wanted to dissolve the treaty. Everything that happened, it was you.
Chapter 70. Anita reaches back for Corey, not looking at him, but finding his hand anyway. He grips it tight.
Anita.
Daniel sounds wounded.
That's a very serious accusation. And as you're still one of my employees...
Not anymore. I quit. As of 10 minutes ago.
Daniel sighs, as if he knew that was coming.
I'm sorry to hear that. And I hope you'll reconsider once you're less emotional.
Excuse me?
Says Hannah. The senator ignores her.
As it is, I'm not going to stand for you accusing me like that, without any evidence.
See? That's the thing, Anita says.
She lets go of Corey's hand, taking a step towards the senator, who still doesn't move. His expression is grave, but there's a look in his eyes that wasn't there before, a wariness.
The whole time we were out there, I kept thinking, who would want to overturn the treaty? Who had the most to gain?
She jabs a finger at Daniel's chest.
And then I realized... It took me a long damn time, but I figured it out.
Careful, says Daniels.
Anita ignores him.
How many times have you talked about how you'd like to change the treaty? How many times did you tell us that we weren't working hard enough, that we needed to find loopholes in the wording? You fought harder than anyone to get it changed so we'd have more territory. It just took me a little while to figure it out.
Anita, listen to yourself.
Daniels reaches out to her, and Everett knocks his arm away. The senator looks at him in mild astonishment.
I should have seen it a lot sooner,
Anita says, shaking her head. Her voice is strained, as if she's about to start crying.
How could you do that? All those people!
This is absurd, Daniels says. You're jumping to conclusions based on, what, me doing my job? As a frontier senator? Looking after our interests? Now, I know you've been through a lot, and you're probably in shock. I'm willing to forgive this outburst, but I should warn you that...
Commander Richard Hayes,
Jack says. Daniels glances at him, irritated.
I beg your pardon? He was in charge of the rescue mission for your boys on the Resolute. Came in on, what was it, the Victory?
He shrugs.
Didn't say much, but I caught his name. Even then, I didn't think much of it until I told Anita here. That's what sold it for me,
Anita says. Everett grabs her free hand, and she holds on tight.
You and Hayes go way back, don't you? All the way to the Frontier Officers Academy. Spoken at some of your fundraisers, from what I recall. And I've seen him around the office plenty of times. My guess is that you two cooked this up together. After all, if we went back to war, you'd both get your peace. So when the Resolute didn't come back on schedule, Hayes himself went to check it out. He'd want to make sure it was done right.
Daniels is smiling to himself, slowly shaking his head.
You forget, Anita says. I've worked with you a long time, Tom. I know when you're lying.
In the silence that follows, Corey could swear the temperature of the room drops 10 degrees. He's still trying to process everything that's just happened, but what he focuses on is his mom and dad, standing together, holding hands, both wanting the same thing.
"It's still just conjecture," Daniel says. "You don't exactly have a smoking gun, do you?"
"Maybe not,"
Jack says.
"But we plan to tell everyone what we know."
Hannah gives him a sharp look. He ignores her.
"They'll join the dots. We can't," Everett tells Daniels. "Dig up more evidence, because, believe me, it's out there. Hope you got a good lawyer, Senator."
"Damn right,"
Malik says. Daniels sighs a second time.
"I was hoping it wouldn't come to this."
He reaches in the pocket of his jacket and pulls out a folded sheet of paper, handing it to Anita. She takes it reluctantly, like it's poisoned, unfolding it.
"Copies have been forwarded to your individual inboxes,"
Daniels says.
"I suggest you read it closely."
"What is it?"
Jack cranes forward to look. The senator smiles that kindly smile again.
"Gag order, effective in all known territories. Got it signed off this morning. And believe me when I say you don't want to mess with this one. Any statement made to any unauthorized individual lines you up for a treason charge. All records of your trip are now property of the frontier."
His eyes meet Anita's.
"As I said, I'd hoped we could avoid this. You're an intelligent woman, Anita. You would have made an excellent senator yourself one day."
Anita reads the paper, mouth moving silently, a look of dismay on her face. Hannah, Jack, and Everett crowd around her. Only Malik stays where he is, fists bunched at his sides.
"I'll leave you to talk it over,"
Daniels says, giving Corey a friendly nod as he walks past the bed.
"It's good to have you all back. I hope you'll cooperate fully with our investigation."
"You can't possibly think you can cover this up,"
Jack says.
"How many people saw us jump in out of nowhere?"
"You don't really get it, do you?"
Daniels says, buttoning his suit jacket.
"You think you made a big entrance, and it'll be news, all right, for a time. But it'll also be easy to explain away. A military scientific program, unintended consequences, untested technology. The conspiracy theorists will have a field day, but nobody listens to them. Oh, I have no doubt they'll do their damnedest to connect Sigma to what happened to you. Probably get pretty close, too. But see..."
He absently shoots a cuff, the sad smile still on his face.
"By the time we're done, the whole thing will be so drawn out and complicated and buried in legalities that nobody'll know what happened. And I'm pretty sure none of you are willing to risk life in prison to tell them."
His eyes land on Corey's brother.
"How about it, Malik? Ready to go to jail in Lunar Max? That's what'll happen if you folks fuck with me."
He walks away, leaving them huddled around the bed. Corey's head falls back on the pillow. He's never heard the phrase, gag order, but he can figure it out.
"How could this happen? After everything they've gone through, it's going to be like it never happened."
"Huh," Hannah says. "That's funny." Daniels opens the door to the ward.
"What is?"
he says, not looking over his shoulder. Corey watches Hannah take the piece of paper from Anita, lifting it to her face.
"The date and time this was signed off. It's only a couple of hours ago. You must have done it before you came to see us."
Daniels fiddles with his watch, gold with a big, chunky dial.
"What about it?"
"Well, the thing is," Hannah says, "Sigma Destination Tours provides its passengers with kind of an interesting service."
She folds the paper up.
"Did you know that anybody who takes a Sigma tour can upload any photos or video they have to the Frontier Public History Archives? All they have to do is log on."
"So what?"
Now Daniels sounds annoyed.
Anything you got is Frontier property, or did you not hear me?
As of 2 hours ago, sure. But we uploaded everything we had when we first arrived above Austin. So about... She glances at Everett, who says,
10 hours ago, give or take.
Daniels looks between them, that same sad smile back on his face. This time, at least to Corey, he looks a little worried.
What are you talking about?
He says.
You should see the video Malik here shot, Jack says. He did a really good job.
I had the panda queue it up for upload before we made the jump, says Hannah. It would have sent the files the second we came back into signal range. They're on the public archives right now. She nudges Jack. Hey, how long do you think it'll take before someone realizes what they're looking at?
Not long.
Anita's eyes are shiny with tears, but her voice is steady and even. Daniels doesn't look friendly anymore. He looks like he wants to kill them.
It doesn't change a damn thing, he says. That footage is still Frontier property. All of it. We'll just delete it off the server. Any one of my people could handle that.
Hannah purses her lips. Delete it off the server? That's cute. Senator, let me tell you something about historians. We don't trust people like you. You're not the first person to try to change the records, and you definitely won't be the last. The archives are publicly run, always have been. They're held across hundreds of thousands of different computers in this system. You'd have to issue an awful lot of gag orders.
You have no idea the resources I have.
I'm sure you do, but it only takes one person to download it, and it'll be out there. Not to mention Sigma Tours themselves. I'm pretty sure they have an office planetside, and they're probably freaking out trying to understand what happened. They might be scrolling through the archives right now.
Don't forget the journalists,
Jack says. Oh yeah, them too. Who knows where they've been looking?
And other tourists, of course, ones who don't know what happened to Sigma yet.
It is a good idea to do plenty of research before a big trip, Everett says. Daniels has gone white. Hannah lifts her chin, her eyes meeting his. Despite the neck brace, she looks, to Corey, like she's 10 feet tall. You'd better think of a good story, she says. You're going to need it. Chapter 71 Titan, Hannah's home moon, has several huge banks of artificial sunlight in its dome colony. Plenty of people complain about them, saying they're too hot or that the plants don't grow quite right. Hannah's never minded them much, but she has to admit, they'll never beat the real thing. She tilts her head back as far as her flexible brace will allow, reclining on the wooden bench in the hospital garden, eyes closed. The sunlight turns the inside of her lids a warm gold. No, the real thing is much, much better. Hannah basks in it, stretching her arms out. Oh, yeah. She's in the central courtyard of the hospital wing, a small space with benches and a few hardy succulents pushing up through the soil in regimented flower beds. There's a half-hearted fountain in the centre. Its pool dry, the spout silent. They've been in Austin City General for 2 days, and she can't believe she only found this place an hour ago. Then again, it took an age to persuade the doctors and nurses that, yes, the nanomeds were working, and, yes, her neck felt better. They wouldn't let her take the brace off, but at least they let her walk around outside the wards. Hannah opens her eyes. A patient in a hover chair, an older man, completely bald, passes her on the other side of the courtyard, a nurse keeping pace alongside him. He spots Hannah and smiles. She returns it, feeling kind of bad. For the past couple of days, the entire hospital has been locked down. Only patients, doctors and nurses were allowed. They only opened up the visitors' lists this morning. It's not hard to see why. The streets outside the hospital are rammed with vehicles from what looks like every feed in existence. Hannah spent a few minutes watching some of them this morning, staring with bemused fascination as they showed endless shots of the front of the hospital at their own photos superimposed on the footage. There's an airspace blackout around the building, so they haven't got any drone cameras up above. Just as well, or the nurses would never have let Hannah come outside. But that hasn't stopped them from trying. The only time they cut away from the hospital is to show footage of the destroyed Victory, sticking up from the shattered mine dumps like an ancient monolith. Oh, and Tom Daniels, looking harassed, surrounded by Secret Service. Hannah doesn't know if they're arresting him or protecting him. Right now, she doesn't much care. The Belarus treaty renegotiations, it appears, are on indefinite hold. Volkova, Seema and Lorinda were taken from the Panda. Hannah doesn't really want to think about their funerals, especially Volkova's. Brendan is in the hospital too, under police guard. Hannah doesn't know who told the cops about him. Anita, maybe. She heard one of the doctors talking about a special prosecutor coming in from Mars. Whoever that is, they'll have their hands full. The soldiers from the Victory, Hayes included, are in the other wing of the hospital, under military protection. Hannah had a dream the night before, after she finally drifted off to sleep in her uncomfortable hospital bed, that the soldiers stormed the wards, taking care of the survivors from the Panda, moving in darkness, eliminating them with double-tap shots. She woke up sweating, the brace clammy against her neck. No one knows where Roman is. He wasn't among the crash survivors, or the bodies. They may have to wait a little longer. There was a big argument about letting authorized visitors in to see people in the hospital, Anita and Everett going back and forth with the hospital administrators, standing side by side in the corridor. The last Hannah had heard, the panicked hospital CEO had been telling them he'd get it in motion. She hopes they figure it out before her parents and her sister get here. She spoke to them a few hours ago. They'd just come through the lunar jump station and were waiting for their transport planetside. The transmission was glitchy, the station signal pixelating their faces. Hannah had told herself she wouldn't cry, but of course she did, almost as much as her mom and dad. Callie had remained dry-eyed, but she looked like she had aged 10 years in 10 hours. Seeing her family had made Hannah's gut clench up, as if they were going to be taken away from her, as if she was still back on the Panda. And this was just another dream, as if a metal sphere was going to come hurtling towards them, obliterating them where they stood. It didn't, and Hannah can't wait for them to get here. Can't wait to hug Callie and her mom, and feel her dad's stubble rasp past her cheek as she wraps her arms around him. She doesn't remember a lot of what they talked about. It was a mess of what the hell happened, and how could they do this, and please tell us you're okay. But she keeps coming back to one part of the conversation, when they'd all mostly calmed down. Callie still looked like she was 40 years old. Some of the life had come back into her. "So what are you going to do?" she'd asked Hannah. "'Cause I don't think the tour guide thing worked out." Hannah had smiled at that, and she'd been on the verge of answering, about to tell them that the plan was the same, that she was still going to go and get a job in a museum and work towards being a curator, somehow. The story was so familiar that she knew every beat of it without thinking. She'd even been bracing herself for the tight smiles, the neutral, "Oh," from her mum, Callie's indifference, her dad's concern. But just before she started speaking, Hannah decided that she didn't feel like dealing with it anymore. "I don't know," she told them.
I'll figure it out. Callie had nodded, told her they'd see her soon, whenever that would be. They'd have to find a place to stay in Austin, and she'd have to get their names onto the visitors' list. Would she be able to leave with them? Her neck didn't hurt nearly as much now, and technically she wasn't a prisoner, so...
Okay, if I join you.
Hannah looks up, squinting against the sunlight. It's Jack. Like her, he's dressed in one of those ridiculous hospital gowns, the sash around the waist cinched tight. She'd heard him griping to the nurse earlier, asking her why he couldn't have some proper pants. Back on the Panda, she would have leapt at the chance to get as far away from him as she could. She still feels that way, a little. But the sun is warm, and her family is on the way, and she didn't die a horrible death in the vacuum of space. All things considered, she's in a pretty good mood, and he did help save them.
Sure,
she says. He nods thanks, lowering himself to the bench. His arm, she sees, is still in a cast, albeit a more flexible one. He must be healing, too, the bone repair nanos doing their work.
I don't know if you heard, he says.
Heard what?
About Brendan and Seema's kid.
For a moment, she has absolutely no idea what he's talking about. Then she remembers.
Brendan made a deal,
he says.
He'd talk about the Roses cartel if they'd get his son back. Apparently they had him in an apartment block in Acidalia. Cops raided the place, managed to get him out okay.
Oh. She doesn't quite know how to respond to that. She should be happy. But right now, it all feels as remote as Sigma itself.
That's good, she says, after a long moment.
Got that right,
he mutters. He shifts on the bench, looking uncomfortable.
Well, maybe not for the kid. Not when your mom and dad are, you know.
Glad he's okay. Hannah can't think of anything else to say.
Right, right. You healing up?
I think so. The doc says I can get the brace off this afternoon. How about you?
About the same.
That's good.
They fall silent. It's not a comfortable silence, either. Jack, Hannah suspects, is the kind of person with whom silences would never be comfortable.
So, what are you going to do next? She says.
She's not sure if she really wants to know, but she hasn't any idea what else to say. He puffs out his cheeks.
Write about what happened, I guess. Maybe a book, I don't know.
Yeah. That'd probably be...
I mean, the whole story is pretty much out there already, so I need to find a new angle on it, one everybody doesn't know already.
Isn't the angle that you were actually there? You saw it happen?
Well, yeah.
He looks annoyed, as if he's regretting telling her his plans. Before she can say anything, he turns on the bench, shifting towards her.
Listen, I wanted to ask you...
Yes?
He doesn't say anything for a few seconds. He hasn't shaved, Hannah realizes. And his stubble is starting to go from a shadow to a beard.
The whole thing with the captain,
Jack says.
I shouldn't have. I mean, I didn't know it would get so...
Seema killed the captain, Hannah says. Seema and Brendan. They were the ones who brought the knife on board.
With this, she knows what to say. She spent plenty of time thinking about it. Jack was an idiot, but in the end, he wasn't the one who murdered Volkova. He's been through enough, and she isn't going to make his life hell. Not after they actually made it out. Jack opens his mouth to say something, then closes it again. He looks down at the ground. Unwilling to meet her eyes.
Thank you,
he says. Hannah doesn't respond. On the other side of the garden, a bird lands, a little brown one, the kind that you always see around Earth cities, pecking at a bright green cactus.
Hannah can just hear the hubbub from the crowds outside the hospital drifting in on the warm breeze.
What about you?
Jack asks her.
Huh? What are you going to do when this is all over?
She's about to tell him that she doesn't know, but she's had plenty of time to think about that, too, since she spoke to Callie and her parents. They're probably not going to like her answer, but that's just tough.
I think I might go to pilot school, she says.
You're kidding.
Not really.
A smile spreads across her face.
Go into the Navy? Fly commercial? I don't know yet.
Wow.
He nods.
That's... wow.
He looks up at the sky, eyes narrowed against the glare.
Well, I'd say you've passed the entry exam.
Hannah actually laughs. She didn't know if she still could.
You know Corey wants to do that too, right?
Jack says. Kind of hard to miss.
You should tell him. He'll get a kick out of...
He stops, interrupted by loud voices from the glass-walled passage across the courtyard, drifting through the open door. A man is shouting, trying to push his way past one of the nurses, who is loudly telling him that he's not supposed to be there, and is he on the visitors list anyway?
Eu tenho derecho,
the man shouts. There's something odd about the way he's walking, his legs slightly too stiff.
Sir! Fora do caminho!
She turns to Jack, intending to ask him if he'd heard anything about visitors being allowed in yet. But he's no longer paying attention to her. He's staring at the commotion, his mouth slightly open, a look of absolute confusion on his face.
Sir, I can't understand you. If you would just... Get out of the damn way,
the man says, switching to English.
I need to see him.
He glances into the courtyard as he pushes past the nurse, and Hannah gets a look at him for the first time. He's around Jack's age, with salt-and-pepper hair, and a thin, bony body under a green shirt and jeans. The shirt hangs off him, slightly too big. And again, Hannah notices his gait, jerky, limping. The man sees Jack, and comes to an abrupt halt.
Friend of yours? Hannah says.
Jack doesn't respond. His mouth is still open. Slowly, he rises off the bench. The man steps through the door, suddenly hesitant, ignoring the angry nurse behind him, who is threatening to call security. Jack says something that is half a breath, half a word. No, not just a word, a name. One Hannah hasn't heard before.
Heck.
Jack?
Hannah asks.
Yeah.
Jack doesn't even look at her.
I'll call you.
As Hannah watches, he starts walking towards the strange man. They meet a few feet from the door. The man starts to say something, but as Hannah watches, Jack puts his arms around him. They rock back and forth, holding on to each other tight, like there's nothing else in the entire world but them. Soon, she'll be able to do that. She can hug her family, hold them close. Everything after that... Well, she'll figure it out. She tilts her head back again, letting the sun splash across her face.
Chapter 72. Corey's hospital room is actually pretty sweet. It's got its own flat screen embedded in one wall. He's already linked it to his lens, which somehow survived everything that happened to him. There's a big window, which can turn frosted or dark at the touch of a button. The room is on the 10th floor and looks out onto the central courtyard. The young doctor with the brown hair moved him here after she was done with his leg, although she insisted on keeping the shield up for the time being. "Don't want another infection setting in," she told him as she positioned his hovering bed. "I'll take it off in the morning." When he asked her how he was supposed to pee, she gave him an evil grin. The shield's taking care of that, too, she said. He thought that was kind of gross, but he didn't push it. He had other stuff to think about. They eventually let visitors in. Jamie and Ally wanted to know everything. Then they wanted him to tell it a second time. And then Ally told the story about how their arrival had knocked her flat, and both of them wanted to know when he was getting out. He wanted to tell them how scary it all was, how it wasn't just some amazing adventure, but he couldn't find the words. And then Mal came back, and his parents, and they talked until they couldn't talk any more. His mom and dad told them that they might have to go to court, that there would probably be quite a few lawyers who wanted to talk to them. His mom had got real serious when she said this, real quiet, like she was expecting an argument. She didn't get one. Corey and Malik, for what was maybe the first time ever, both said yes in unison. For Corey, it was enough that his dad was holding his mom's hand tight, that he didn't let go, that his mom wouldn't let him. They watched a feed for a while on the big flat screen, and he found he was too tired to make sense of any of it. His brain felt like it was leaking out of his ears. At some point, he fell asleep. When he woke up, the sun outside the window had almost set, the last of the light making him squint. The room is empty, quiet, the flat screen off, the lights turned low. There's an old-fashioned paper notepad on the side table. Malik has written a message for him. "Hope you don't have to pee in the night," smiley face. He smiles, putting the pad back on the table. There's another note, this one a folded piece of paper with his name on it. It's from his mom, her neat handwriting, telling him that they love him and that they'll get him some actual clothes soon. "Pants are gone," she's written. "They had to cut them off. Sorry, but we can get some new ones." Now that he's alone, without everyone around him, his brain has calmed down a little, enough to wonder some more about what's going to happen next. He knows he can't just pick up where he left off. How is he going to be able to go back to school? Is he going to be able to hang out with Jamie and Ally? He knows what they've done. What they found out is big, like really big, like the kind of thing that changes the world, the whole frontier, not to mention the colonies. It's like his mom said, there are going to be lawyers and court people and who knows what else. After a while, he puts the note back on the table. The clothes his mom mentioned are piled neatly on it, his T-shirt folded on top, his shoes poking out from underneath. He's about to lie back on the bed when he stops, looks more closely. There's something poking out from underneath his T-shirt, something he doesn't recognize, a piece of tattered grey fabric. Corey frowns. He picks up the touchpad, raising the top half of the bed as high as it will go. Then he leans over, wincing as his muscles take the strain. He can't quite get to his T-shirt, his fingers just touching it, trying to pull it towards him. If only the shield wasn't locked in place. He snags it between finger and thumb, gently pulls it towards him. A few moments later, he has the mysterious fabric in his hand. He lifts it out, eyes huge. It's a patch, torn from an item of clothing. A red and black patch with crossed daggers, the details picked out in crude stitching. Roman's patch. Startled, Corey looks around the room, as if expecting the soldier to be standing right there. Nothing. It's empty, silent and dark. Somewhere distant, he can hear a voice making an announcement through a speaker, the words inaudible behind the closed door. Corey leans back,
holding the patch against his chest, looking out of the window. He stays that way until sleep finally takes him again, and the sun is long gone behind the buildings.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Adrift, written by Rob Boffard, performed by Katie Scarfe. Copyright by Rob Boffard, 2018. Production copyright, 2018 by Audible Limited. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Limited.